Jessica Ramos from Trade Unionist in Solidarity with Colombia summarized the struggle at the Coca-Cola bottling plants in Colombia.
We can no longer sit still. We can no longer keep quiet as we learn of the atrocities these men and women in Colombia are experiencing. Threats, kidnappings, tortures, and murders have taken place in response to unionization. We believe earning a living wage in order to provide ourselves and our families with food, shelter, and clothing is a human right, and we will stop at nothing to defend it.
Luis Adolfo Cardona witnessed the assassination of union contract negotiator Isidro Segundo Gil at the Carepa bottling plant in 1996, and he had to flee the country after paramilitaries attempted to kidnap him.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting February 9th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Here's a tiny bit more about one radical struggle in Colombia. Thanks for listening.
I noticed the paramilitaries had jumped back onto the motorcycle and were fleeing the scene. When I reached his body, I put my hands under his head. At that point, I realized that his head had come apart in my hands. My hands were covered in his blood. I noticed that his two young daughters rushed towards him, and now in his pool of blood, were telling him, "Daddy, Daddy, wake up, don't leave us."
This Week in Radical History, for February 9th, 1886, President Cleveland declares a state of emergency in Seattle because of anti-Chinese violence. Since the disgraceful butchery of the Chinese in Wyoming several months ago, the anti-Chinese feeling in the extreme Northwest has become more violent and nearly universal. Following a declaration that Chinese are, quote, immoral and degraded and a constant menace to free institutions, to the home, and to the family. The Chinese were the Mexicans of their day. Now neo-Nazi skinheads are on the rise in this country and all over the world.
Hate crimes against Latinos have risen nearly 40% since 2003. The National Hispanic Media Coalition wants to know whether a spike in anti-Latino hate speech on TV and radio, coming not just from the fringes but well-known talkers like Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh, is contributing to the violence. Last week, the group called upon the Federal Communications Commission to investigate the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
This is a national epidemic. The growth is spurred each day by hate speech, distortion of facts, and anti-immigrant sentiment expressed on cable shows, local radio shows, and across the airwaves. The serious topic of immigration has been contaminated by hatred and racism, and it's created a toxic climate which fosters and condones violence, all motivated by bigotry.
The more we forget our own history, the more horrors will be revisited. Also on February 9th, 1917, San Francisco labor agitator Tom Mooney is falsely convicted of a fatal bombing. He is pardoned and released 22 and a half years later. Thomas Mooney's show trial was conducted in a lynch mob atmosphere and featured several witnesses whose testimony was coached by the prosecutor. It included one witness who claimed her astral body was at the scene. Also on February 9th, 1982, President George Bush Sr. denies he ever used the phrase voodoo economics and challenges anybody to find it. NBC's Ken Doty promptly broadcast the 1980 tape in which he said the phrase.
Does anyone know what Vice President Bush called this in 1980? Anyone? Something D-O-O economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Anyone? Anyone?
Lastly, for February 9, 1994, a Senate report reveals the U.S. did ship biological agents, WMD, to Iraq with Reagan's approval. Just in case there's any debate about that.
Anyone? Anyone?
This Week in Radical History, for February 10, 1855. The Women's Hospital in New York City is founded. Although it did provide much-needed care for poor women, the hospital is also an arena for J. Marion Sims, known for his hatred of women and ruthlessly cutting up their bodies. Here he will perform brutal operations using indigent women as guinea pigs before audience of men. Sims began his career performing dangerous sexual surgeries on black slave women who were housed in a stable in his yard. On one particular slave, he performed 30 operations. After the affiliation with New York Women's Hospital, Sims performed the same number of operations on an Irish indigent Mary Smith. Internationally famous and honored by his peers, Sims was the object of adulation from the Harvard Medical School, counted as one of the immortals. I guess you can be immortal if you sell your soul to the devil.
Anyone? Anyone?
Also on February 10th, 1892 in Spain, four farm workers are executed during a repression following an uprising in January of Jerez, setting off a new wave of violence in Spain. Last month, hundreds of farm workers calling them a social revolution took over the town of Jerez, The insurrection was quickly subdued and leaders captured and tortured. Anarchists would fight a good fight for years in Spain, including in 1932, the anarcho-syndicalist NCT proclaimed general strike and more insurrections followed. Within the week, the Catalonia city of Teresa is taken over and anarchist commune is declared. Two more items for February 10, 1961. The Voice of Nuclear Disarmament pirate radio station begins operating off the shores of England. Las Anas State, 1962. Francis Gary Powers, a CIA pilot in a super-secret U-2 airplane, is captured by the Russians. When the United States government learned that Powers disappeared over the Soviet Union, it issued a cover statement claiming that a weather plane had crashed down after a pilot had difficulties with his oxygen tank. What U.S. officials did not realize was the plane crashed almost fully intact and the equipment was obviously not used for weather forecasting since it was long-range telescoping lens that aimed down. After Powers had finally returned to the United States, he is criticized by his handlers for not using the CIA-issued suicide pin. I wonder if that suicide pin was the flag lapel pin on his jacket.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, February 11th, 1916, black feminist and American civil rights activist Florence Kennedy was born in Kansas City, Missouri. Flo Kennedy began her career as a lawyer, but quickly lost faith in the American judicial system and decided that practicing law might never be an effective means of changing society or resisting oppression. Flo turned to political activism and in 1966 set up an organization called the Media Workshop to fight racism in journalism and advertising. She continued her struggle for justice both in the courts and on the streets, aligning herself with movements from the Black Panther Party to abortion rights, and even publicly rallied against the Vietnam War. Flo's political activism extended in all directions, and one of her favorite mottos was that you have to fight on all the fronts, all the time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also this week in radical history, on February 11th, 1978, Longest Walk begins. 300 Native Americans start march from Alcatraz in San Francisco, California to Washington, D.C., organized by the American Indian Movement, AIM, to shine a light on the plight of indigenous peoples in America. Also on February 11, 1987, President Reagan tells the Tower Commission he did not approve arms sales to Iran, which was a lie, after the weapons sales were revealed in November of 1986. Ronald Reagan appeared on national television and stated that the weapons transfer he intended to occur, but the United States did not trade arms for hostages. The investigation was compromised when large volumes of documents relating to the scandal were destroyed or withheld from investigators by the Reagan administration officials. Same old, same old. Only two more items for February 11, 1990. South Africa political prisoner Nelson Mandela is released after 27 years in prison by the U.S.-supported apartheid government of South Africa. Also on the state in 2006, duck everybody duck. After a couple of noon toddies, Vice President Dick Cheney, armed and dangerous with a shotgun, peppers a millionaire contributor, shooting him in the face while bird hunting.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 12th, in 1853, Illinois passed a law stating that no black person from another state was allowed to stay in their state for more than 10 days. If they were caught, they were to be arrested and either subject to a $50 fine or temporarily auctioned into forced labor. These laws, known as black laws, were extremely common in the southern states, and the state of Illinois had particularly harsh tactics. Although Illinois entered the Union as a free state in 1818, slavery had existed there for almost 100 years and continued to exist for a long time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The most effective way to challenge the distortions, myths, and outright lies of the Israeli narrative, which drives American policy, is to present the historical, documented facts which we describe as the Palestinian narrative. This Week in Palestine systematically tries to present that narrative each week, well-researched, well-documented history, and the analysis and opinion which flows from that history. And no one is more reliable in that presentation of the narrative than new historian Ilan Pappe. That is why we feature him so often on this program, and why we do so again this week. So our extended feature presentation is Professor Ilan Pappe speaking in Sydney, Australia, where the Jewish lobby was unsuccessful in their attempts to prevent this lecture from occurring.
Professor Pappe, Ilan has paid a significant personal price for his commitment to truth and justice. The management, as I mentioned, at his university undertook a process of persecution that was aimed at expelling him from his position. Please join me in welcoming Professor Pappe.
And thank you all for attending this lecture. I want to thank the organizers. I know it took some effort and persuasion. And finally, I'm here. This is my first talk, so it'd still be, the impact of the jet lag would probably still be recognized, hopefully not for too long. What I would like to do is to talk about one of my latest books, which is called The Forgotten Palestinians. And through that concept of the forgotten Palestinians, hopefully say something more general about the situation in Israel and Palestine. Needless to say, of course, as the discussion would be opened up, I would be very happy to engage in a conversation not only about the particular topic I'm talking about, but on Israel and Palestine in general. In the mid-1950s, David Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, was out of office for a short year and a half due to internal political struggles within the then hegemonic dominant Labour Party. And the position of Prime Minister was in the hands of Moshe Sharet, who most of the time was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. But just for a year and a half before the Sinai campaign, he was the Prime Minister. And Ben-Gurion went to voluntary exile in his kibbutz in the Negev, Sde Boker, and had more time, as he wrote in his diary, to go around the country and see the people, which when you are as a prime minister, I suppose you have less time to do. And one of his tours in that moment of political lull one of these trips was to the north of Israel, to the Galilee. And he visited a military compound, a high school, a new factory, several kibbutzim. And all in all, it seems, at least according to the diary, that the day was quite satisfactory. But one thing clouded the day, one thing made the day not such a pleasant date. He wrote, there were too many Arabs in the Galilee. He didn't realize that. And I think that is very important because Ben-Gurion, as a prime minister, of course, was engaged with the question of Arab-Jewish relationship in the newly born state. But there is a difference between seeing something as a living experience and conceptualizing an issue as part of a strategy. So as part of a strategy, he knew that a very small number of Palestinians all in all remained in the Jewish state after 1948. But then concentrating in the trip in the Galilee, which was one of the few areas in Palestine where relatively the number of Palestinians was still high in the 1950s, he saw for the first time the incomplete result of what I called in one of my earlier books the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And he found it troublesome because Ben-Gurion in the mid-1950s believed that those Palestinians he had seen in the Galilee were a fifth column, were potential traitors, potential collaborators with the enemy. And this led him to take two strategic decisions which he will implement when he will come back as a prime minister in the early months of 1956. The first was not to let off the military regime that was imposed on the Palestinians in Israel immediately after the 1948 war, because quite a few people, including his nemesis, Menachem Begin, the leader of the right-wing Herut Party, strongly advised the prime minister to abolish the military rule. He said it doesn't stand to reason that so many citizens of a state would be under a military rule, and definitely people on the left asked him to abolish it. But after trips like this to the Galilee, he was sure it would be a fatal mistake not to continue a very ruthless and callous military rule in the Palestinian areas within the State of Israel. So that was one strategic decision. And only after he would leave politics altogether in the mid-1960s will the military rule on the Palestinians in Israel come to an end. You really needed to remove Ben-Gurion from politics to abolish that military rule, and I'll come back to the military rule in a moment. The second strategic decision he made was that the Galilee, especially the Galilee, needed to be Judaized. He there and then conceived, I think, the idea, which became later on a governmental policy, of initiating a project which is called the Judaization of the Galilee. All kinds of red lights blinking here. I hope it's not the Israeli Secret Service or something. But, is this significant or not? You don't think so? Okay. I had a traumatic lecture tour in America where all kinds of Zionist activists used all kinds of tactics to try and disrupt talks, so I thought maybe this was something like this. Anyway, the Judaization of the Galilee was not just a theoretical concept. He immediately set up a committee, and a very important person that committee is the present-day president of Israel, Shimon Peres, how to make sure that the demographic balance in the Galilee would be dramatically shifted. The numbers he had in the 1950s were very alarming, and that's what led him, I think, to write in his diary there were too many Arabs. It was not just a kind of an intuitive impression that the Galilee is full of Arabs, and not only that the landscape, and indeed the landscape of the Galilee then looked more like an Arab area with the Palestinian villages and so on compared to many other parts of what used to be Palestine and became the State of Israel. But demographically, in the 50s, 50% of the people in the Galilee were Palestinians. And he found that almost suicidal. And then he decided to set up this committee in which Shimon Peres was a particularly important figure. And their plan, which he approved, was to build intensively Jewish settlements all around the major Palestinian villages and towns in the Galilee, and to build them in a way that would disrupt, as they called it, natural continuity between the Palestinian habitats. The worst kind of threat in their eyes was the only Palestinian town, Nazareth, which was a very small town during the mandatory period. The reason it became such a relatively huge place was because it hosted most of the refugees from the Palestinian villages around it, and it tripled in number compared to what it used to be in the mandate. And one of the first initiative was to build Upper Nazareth, an urban sprawl that was meant to strangulate the Palestinian city of Nazareth and to make sure that it does not expand in any geographical way, which it didn't until today. The number of people in Nazareth tripled since 1948, but the space remained the same. And that somehow, these two strategic decisions to continue military rule in those areas and to Judaize the Galilee, on the other hand, set the Ben-Gurion's mind to rest. The end of this story is, of course, that if you form today the first Jewish town within the project of Judaization, that is Upper Nazareth, if you form the municipality there, and you ask them how many Palestinians reside in this town, which is supposed to be purely Jewish, ideologically and strategically, they would say none. And then you would say to them, but, you know, I've just toured Upper Nazareth, and I've seen quite a lot of Palestinians. And then they would say, all right, but we're not at liberty to depart with such information. And the information is that almost 30% of the people who live in that town, which was meant to strangulate the Palestinian town of Nazareth, 30% of the people who live there are Palestinians. So I think that if Ben-Gurion would have been alive today and made another tour to the Galilee, it would have been even more awful than that trip back in the 1950s. The situation of the Palestinians inside Israel is important not because they are forgotten. So I thought it was good to write a book about a particular Palestinian community that is usually excluded from the political and historical agenda of the Israeli-Palestine conflict. That was good enough reason by itself to focus on that community. But there was another reason. I think that it is exactly the kind of attitude that Israel developed throughout the years as an official organization, the state, and the society alike. The kind of attitudes that developed towards the Palestinian minority inside Israel are a very good indication why it is so difficult for us, even those of us who are long-time activists and definitely those of us who are students of the topic for so many years, why is it so difficult either to provide a clear definition of the nature of Israel, or even if we are convinced that we know the answer, whether we use apartheid or settler colonialist state or whatever we use, or even democratic state, if some of us still do that, why it's so difficult to convince others to adapt our definitions. And one of the main reasons for this fluency in the definition is the relationship between the state and the Palestinian minority, because they are treated much better than any other Palestinian group. There's no doubt about that. And yet they live under very unique circumstances that actually prove, at least in my eyes and the eyes of many other critical observers, that defining Israel as a democracy would be wrong if one takes the case study of the Palestinian minority as a litmus test, as a test for this assumption. Because most people would say, yes, because Israel occupies the West Bank, it cannot be defined as a democracy. But I'm saying no, it's exactly because, not only because of the occupation, it is because of the way the Palestinian minority is treated that we should have questions about and challenge the assumption that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And of course, defining Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East is the basis for the Western and American, especially American, support for Israel, and is the main immunity shield that allows Israel to pursue its policies comparatively without any official pressure and criticism from the political and economic elites of the West. So the best way to examine the very unique circumstances in which the Palestinian minority in Israel lives is just to do a short tour into the past to understand how the current reality in which they live materialized. And I think a lot from that history can be, a lot of what we can learn from that history can help us understand better the reality today. And it really connects to many questions that I know trouble us as a community of activists. For example, the question of a one-state or a two-state solution is closely connected to the fate and the future of the Palestinian minority in Israel. What kind of Israel would be there should there ever be a peaceful solution is also connected to that question. But far more profound questions are also, hopefully, will come out from such an historical journey. For instance, whether Israel is a Western European entity in the midst of the Arab world, or should it be part of the Arab world, part of its problems and part of its solutions. And much of what the Palestinians in Israel have to offer has gives you an idea of where can it go from here. Because for the present, what we have is, of course, an Israeli-Jewish political, intellectual, and cultural elite that wishes to maintain the Zionist dream of creating a kind of a Central European Republic in the midst of the Arab world. Most Israeli Jews still have this dream of an earthquake that would take Israel away from the Middle East and append it to, hopefully, to Norway, but if it's not possible, if it's not possible, at least to Italy. I think they will be content with Malta, but I'm not sure about that. And this is the kind of reality which they could have faced better had they had a different kind of relationship with the Palestinian minority inside Israel. So let me just do the brief historical journey, and hopefully these two or three main themes that I mentioned, the one state, the two states, Israel cultural identity, and the question of democracy. I hope these three issues at least will come out very clearly. As probably most of you know, when we talk about the Palestinians in Israel, we talk about the group that was left intact, in a way, inside what became the State of Israel. It's important to remind ourselves that the State of Israel was founded on 80% of what used to be mandatory Palestine, 80%. And in that 80%, about 1 million Palestinians lived. Out of the 1 million Palestinians, only 100,000 so remained. So, first of all, we're talking here about a group of people who lost within few months 90% of their own community. And one can only imagine, unless one went through it personally, I can only imagine the trauma of such a dramatic transformation in one's life. Now, it was not just losing your community, it was, of course, witnessing how the landscape changed from being Mediterranean, if you want, Arab, in certain places Islamic, and how it suddenly transforms into a kind of a modern version of settler colonialist communities around you. At least a quarter of these people were refugees in their own homeland. They were expelled from their villages and towns, but were not expelled outside the boundaries of the newly formed Jewish state. Now, one has to understand that being a refugee then within the state of Israel meant watching very closely how your former house, your former field, your former shop is being taken by others and being rebuilt as a Jewish settlement or as a Jewish factory or as a Jewish farmland. And sometimes probably for a refugee to see this is far more traumatic and painful than living in exile somewhere, not knowing exactly what happened to the land or the house or the business which used to be yours. There are several poignant cases, but I particularly think of one particular neighborhood in Nazareth which was built after 1948, was not built actually, was re-inhabited by a new people because those people who lived there originally were expelled. And they re-inhabited a new, an old neighborhood that was exactly above the village that was occupied in 1948, destroyed, and rebuilt as a Jewish settlement with an old Hebrew name. And of course, the first thing you do in Israel of the 1950, you bring the archaeologists. And the first piece of clay that they find is enough to convince everyone that there is an eternal scientific proof that this used to be a biblical town, and therefore actually this was not expulsion and ethnic cleansing, this was a redemption or redeeming an ancient place. The place I'm thinking about is Tzipori, and the name of the village is Safuria. And the name of the neighborhood that overlooks Safuria is called Safafra. So you can see, even if you are not speaking Hebrew or Arabic, how these names are, all four names are connected. But the traumatic experience watching your houses and real estate and whatever was in it looted and taken by others was not, of course, the only difficult aspect of being a Palestinian in Israel in the first 20 years of statehood. The most difficult one was to be subjected to the military rule, which I've mentioned before. Now, the military rule is an interesting outfit because it was devised by the British in the 1940s. These were actually British mandatory emergency regulations, which the British imposed mainly against the Jewish undergrounds in the 1940s. In fact, some of the Israeli politicians who imposed these regulations on the Palestinians in Israel called them in the 1940s, or resembled them in the 1940s, to the Nuremberg Laws of 1930s. But somehow this comparison was lost in history when they were reimposed on Arabs. When they are imposed on Jews, they are Nuremberg law. When they are imposed on Arabs, there are safety measures. And those of you who have been to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip don't have to use much imagination in order to realize what the security regulations were all about. They are the same features of military rule that are being experienced by Palestinians in the West Bank today, which gives any junior officer in the army absolute control of the civilian life. The soldiers are the judges, they are the executive, they are the legislative, and they have absolute control in your life. I do think that the military rule of the Palestinians inside Israel was worse than the military occupation of today, because the military rule, or the apparatus of the military rule in the 1950s and the 1960s, was manned by soldiers who were very much on the margins of the Jewish society. Everybody who was not considered to be useful to the Israeli army in any other mean was sent to govern a Palestinian community. So they were quite depressed people, and they vented their frustration on the Palestinian community in ways that are very cruel, but also sometimes very bizarre. And those of you who have read, because I know it was translated into English, the lovely novel by the late Palestinian-Israeli author, Emil Habibi, the Optimist, can have a humorous view on that particular life. Even with his humor, the pain comes through. One of the most ultimate kind of use of force under such circumstances was a massacre in 1956 in Kafr Qasim, where 49 people were massacred by these kind of soldiers. But this was just the tip of the iceberg. On a daily basis, human rights and civil rights of these Palestinians were violated within Israel, that already then was depicted in the West as the only democracy in the Middle East. I noted before that this kind of military rule, which I describe in my book, The Forgotten Palestinians, of course, in more detail, and I'm not the only one, even several good personal memoirs who've just come out lately that give an in-depth into that period. I mentioned that this period in the life of the Palestinians in Israel came to an end when David Ben-Gurion was no more in power, and that's true. But there was another reason why military rule in Israel and Palestine, in Israel, ended in 1966. There was another reason. And the reason was that, contrary to the conventional history of the June 67 war, that sees it as an event that sort of springs out of the blue, the common narrative of the 67 war is of an Egyptian leader, Jamal Abdel Nasser, who tries to create a new coalition of radical Arab forces whose one of their aims is to destroy the Jewish state, and Israel has to preempt his attempt to eliminate the Jewish state in June 1967, and miraculously the Israeli army defeats six or seven, I don't remember, Arab armies and so on. I'm sure you're familiar with the. If not, you can ring the Israeli embassy 24 hours a day. I'm sure they will give you a bite sound that would satisfy you. Well, it's part of the story. I'm not saying that this is totally false, describing it in such a way. But another part of the story, which is very important, is that the Jewish leadership was very much disappointed from not occupying the West Bank in 1948, when it had an historical opportunity to to do so. And ever since 1948, was looking for a pretext to occupy the West Bank. And it was very clear, and now that the documents are open, it's even clearer, that in 1966, it was in the air that such an eventuality is about to happen. Nobody knew exactly whether it would be June 67. Nobody knew exactly that Nasser would do what he did. But there was a preparation ever since the mid-1960s in Israel to the eventuality of occupying the West Bank. And there was also already a strategic plan ready. That's why the Israelis so quickly, I always was amazed by it. I was already then witnessing it with my own eyes, how quickly the Israelis were controlling the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The answer is they were ready for it about 3 or 4 years earlier. But what was important, that in order to envisage the possibility of what you do after you occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, you had to envisage what kind of mechanism will you use to control it. And it was very clear that what you needed was to transfer the military rule imposed on the Palestinians inside Israel and use it for controlling a new group of Palestinians, namely those of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And most of the people who were in high positions in the military rule that controlled the lives of the Palestinians inside Israel would be the first to operate the same military rule with the same emergency regulations in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip immediately after the end of the June 1967 war. So the military rule comes to an end when it's clear that another group of Palestinians is about to be under Israeli control, because this is the history of Zionism. It has a demographic dimension and it has a geographical dimension. It needs a successful Jewish project or Zionist project in Palestine is about space. How much of Palestine do you need to exist? And how many Palestinians inside that space can you tolerate to exist? Now, the more space you want, the more Palestinians you have. The less space you have, the less secure you feel. I'm not testing now whether these are good assumptions or bad assumptions. They're just part of the Zionist catechism. And this being Sunday and the opening of the Jewish New Year, I thought it would be good to be a bit religious. And so it was clear they are going to take more land with many more Palestinians in it, and they needed to know how to control it. So, in a way, the Palestinians in Israel benefited from the new strategy to expand the borders and to digest an additional number of Palestinians as part of the citizens, as part of Israel's domain. Then the Palestinians in Israel became a topic for strategic discussion among Israeli politicians of how to proceed without the military rule. Because the military rule is a very clear tool. How do you control a quarter of your population whom you suspect of being a fifth column, who you don't regard as an integral or organic part of your nation, and whom you really would like to see disappear. And yet, at the same time, and this is also genuine, at the same time, you do wish to be a democracy. You do wish to be a democracy. You do wish to be humane in your treatment. And even if you don't have these two impulses, to be democratic and humane, you want to be seen as such for the sake of getting American aid and diplomatic support from Australia all the way up to Washington. And that's a problem. I mean, that's a big problem. Now, one thing is very clear. The basic attitude between of the state and the society, unfortunately, at large, to the Palestinian minority in Israel has not changed. And there's so many surveys and censuses that are being conducted on a yearly basis, sometimes on bi-monthly basis, that show that this has not changed. For the vast majority of Jews in Israel, and for the vast majority of those who are at the center of policy making in Israel, the Palestinians of Israel are an existential problem. And the best solution would have been if they wouldn't have been there, but it's impossible, of course, to achieve that. So this kind of tension between what you want and what you can do is very indicative. What also comes clear is that the Israeli policymakers, legislators, academics, security people think that the best way to go along with this dilemma is to work all the time on two levels. One is the potential level, and one is the actual level. The potential level says that in the value system of the state, its existence dwarfs any other value. Namely, if at any given moment any kind of development in the relationship between the state and the Palestinian minority would endanger the existence of the state in the eyes of its policymakers, then every means is justified, including the ethnic cleansing of that population. And this was clearly stated even by Netanyahu in this famous Herzliya conferences we have in Israel. Herzliya is a kind of old people's home for university professors who don't know how to retire. So they build a private university for them. But they're very prestigious, and they get all the people in the land to come and give them speeches about their programs. And they talk there about the Palestinians in Israel as a demographic bomb or demographic problem. The noun changes, but the message is the same over the years. So potentially, every Palestinian who lives inside Israel as a citizen knows that they are on probation. Their existence in the state is conditional, not so much based on their behavior, but how their behavior would be perceived by the authority. For instance, when they demonstrated in support of the Second Intifada, the Israeli government decided that their police can stop such demonstrations with shoot-to-kill policy. 13 Palestinian citizens paid with their life. And it worked. Since then, you don't have massive Palestinian demonstrations. But of course, they can erupt again. But this was a red line. You cannot demonstrate on such a level anymore. And there are all kinds of other issues. I don't have the time to go into it, but maybe in the Q&A session we can expand on it. But I want you to understand that this is the kind of trick that Israelis play, what I call the potential reality. In the potential reality, the Palestinian citizens of Israel have no citizenship, have no basic human and civil rights. But in real life, they do. They do. But it can take between 1 minute and 10 seconds, or 10 seconds to 1 minute, to change from one situation to the other, because the military regulations of Israel are still intact. And according to the military regulations, any military officer at any given moment can declare an area where Palestinian citizens live as a military zone. And the moment it's a military zone, all their basic human rights and civil rights are gone. It doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often. But it's possible to do that. So we are left with the real life of being a Palestinian in Israel, not the potential threat. But of course, one cannot separate the two. On three levels, Palestinians in Israel cannot be regarded as full citizens. And this absence of full citizenship is indicative to all the three questions I raised before about Israel being a democracy, the one-state, two-state solution, and the cultural identity of Israel. On the legal basis, Israel has a set of laws that directly discriminate the Palestinians in Israel. in any aspect of life. Now, this was not very apparent until about 15 years ago. In fact, the official legal discrimination was not very visible. For some reason, and again, I don't have the time to go into it, ever since 2000, there is a new intensity of legislation that totally made redundant any effort by scholars to understand whether Israel is an apartheid state or not. They probably knew about our predicament and decided to start legislating in such a manner that forces me to burn some of my previous books and my previous articles. There's no need anymore for any elaborate kind of deconstruction. No, we don't need Michel Foucault anymore for understanding why Israel is an apartheid state. The less visible aspects are in the executive, if one can put it this way, the way that budgets are distributed, all kinds of social privileges, development plans. I've already mentioned the fact that Nazareth cannot expand, but this is true about any Palestinian area. In the 64 years of Israel existence, 500 new Jewish settlements inside Israel were built. Not even one Palestinian village was allowed to be built, let alone expand. But there's a similar discrimination in school budgets, health education, and so on. The trick, before the legislation made it clear, the trick was to connect this kind of government assistance in building or developing an infrastructure to service in the army. It said that if you serve in the army, you are entitled to all these things, and because the Palestinians do not serve in the army, that's why they are discriminated against. Not because they are Palestinians, but it's not true because also the ultra-Orthodox don't serve in the army, and rather than being discriminated in budgets, they are overcompensated in budgets. So that doesn't work that well, and the few Palestinians who do serve in the army, like the Druze and the Bedouins, cannot testify that such an agreement brought any improvement in their living conditions either. So that doesn't work. And then the third level is probably the most important level in many ways, is the invisible ceilings and glass walls. And I don't think in this respect the Palestinians fare differently from any minority group in any societies. But the interesting thing is, from a scholarly point of view, that the only literature you have in order to compare what Palestinians in Israel feel when they face a judge or a tax collector or the security person in the airport, that the only literature we have is that of immigrants, especially immigrants of the last wave. But we have to remind ourselves that the Palestinians in Israel are not immigrants. The state immigrated into their life. They did not immigrate into the state. And therefore, I think this is far more problematic in the kind of relationship that develops between the Palestinian minority and Israel. I would try to conclude here because I really want to open the floor for as many comments and questions as possible by saying that in the Oslo process in 1993, two very important Palestinian groups were forgotten. The Palestinian refugees and the exilic communities on the one hand, and the Palestinian minority in Israel. Because this is the basis of a two-state solution. It has to think of Palestine as being only 20% of Palestine, and has to think about the Palestinians as being only 50% of the Palestinians. Now, there are many among us, some of them are very good friends of mine, who believe that this is realpolitik, that you have to accept it, that the Palestinians are actually only those who live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and that Palestine, what can you do, can only be these 20%, namely the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and you won't have a solution if you don't accept these two reductionist perceptions of what is Palestine and who are the Palestinians. But the Palestinians in Israel, like the refugees, will not disappear. even if you'll have a two-state solution tomorrow. And I think that this is the most important part of the story, that the predicament, the tensions, the violations, the inhumanity, the historical mistakes and atrocities that were triggered by a noble idea of Jews who wanted to save themselves by colonizing Palestine, that all these historical chapters would not be dealt with properly if we will continue to think that Palestine is only the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and if we will continue to exclude the Palestinian refugees and the Palestinians in Israel from a prospective solution. It's almost like someone who has a disease all over his body and you tend to his hands or legs and you say, yeah, I know the heart is not working too well, but until he dies, he will have good use of his two hands. That is not a solution. That in many ways, it's quite a torture rather than a solution. There is no way of squaring circles. There cannot be a Jewish democratic state. There cannot be an Islamic democratic state, and there cannot be a Christian democratic state. There can be a democratic state. And if you may not think highly of democracy, and I won't blame you given what we've all experienced, but let's say that we are willing to settle for a democracy as a good political system, or the lesser of all evils. If the Palestinians in Israel and in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip and those who were refugees will not be entitled to equal civil and human rights, there will never be a democracy. However you're going to partition the land and repartition it, or federate it or confederate it, you will have to go not to the geographical issue, but to the rights issue. And the price for the Jewish community is going to be very high, undoubtedly. A democratic Israel will not be a Jewish state. That's true. So this is something that Israelis would have to come to terms, because all their attempts to square the circle by saying we'll be both Jewish and both democratic, the history of the Palestinians in Israel proves that it is not possible. And sometimes in life you have to make a choice, and you have to ask yourself, what would you like your children to be in the future? Citizens of a democratic, free state, or citizens of an apartheid Jewish state? These are the only two options.
That was Israeli new historian Ion Pape speaking on the forgotten Palestinians in Sydney, Australia. We are out of time, and that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We hope you will join us again next Sunday, when we will return to our coverage of the Jewish lobby's assault on campus free speech. We will hear about two reports that were published last year documenting the systematic attempts to silence the Palestinian voice on campuses, criticizing the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and promoting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you. My shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have.
The Reagan Bush administration and Congress decided that they were going to deregulate, quote unquote, savings and loans. And this allowed SNLs to basically invest their money and lend their money on anything they wanted to, and was an open invitation to the criminal element. And sure enough, the mafia was one of the first people, groups involved in looting SNLs in the early 80s. And the deregulation that Bush was in charge of did that. So we, in a sense, were financing these covert illegal operations. And it's the way that, of course, Oliver North, William Casey, it's the way that George Bush, the way they like to do things. Well, we all hear about it. It's going to cost taxpayers about $500 billion. That includes a little over $200 billion of actual losses that the SNLs have incurred that fail, that the taxpayers are going to have to pay back. But when you throw in interest and carrying costs, you get over $500 billion in direct costs. But the other costs are almost as bad. What these fraudulent SNLs did was create an artificial real estate bubble where they inflated real estate values artificially very much, and then the bubble burst. The fallout from that spread to the banks and insurance companies and any other financial institutions that were lending on real estate. So the effects spread out through the economy in the real estate value. So it's not just $500 billion, which is an incredible hit, but also the indirect real estate effects.
You're listening to episode 732 of Unwelcome Guests. A billion here and a billion there. Pretty soon, you're talking real money. I'm Robin Upton. And full marks if you attributed that quote to Illinois Senator Everett Dirksen, and bonus marks if you know that it's actually uncertain whether he ever said it, but it's very widely attributed to him. And when asked whether he had said it, he said, "No, I never said that. A newspaper fella misquoted me once, and I thought it sounded so good that I never bothered to deny it." So, either way, seems that was the image he wished to project. This episode isn't about Everett Dirksen. I just thought that quote was a good way to sum up the content. It's actually Pete Bruton on the savings and loan fraud. We haven't actually had an Unwelcome Guests episode on this particular financial misadventure. I say misadventure. It wasn't good for the American taxpayer. Of course, it did pay off for those few who instigated it. And most tellingly, there hasn't really been any investigation, never mind punishment, of most of the people involved. Full credit for this week's material goes to Douglas Kellner and Frank Moreau, producers of Alternative Views. I've simply run together episodes 483 and 484 with a musical interlude to provide light relief. I couldn't find any better material than this. This is Pete Bruton exposing the events from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, what the commercially controlled media dubbed the SNL crisis.
Today, Alternative Views will interview Pete Bruton concerning his book, The Mafia, CIA, and George Bush. Pete is a former Houston Post reporter who broke the story of the connections between the SNL scandal and the CIA, exposing how CIA assets would borrow money from the SNLs to finance off-the-book operations and then declare bankruptcy and leave U.S. taxpayers with the bill. Well, for the past 5 years, Pete has been tracking down who actually profited from the SNL scam, who the main players were, and how they skimmed off their money. Lo and behold, Pete discovered that the beneficiaries of the SNL scandals were friends of George Bush and his family, unsavory folks connected to the CIA and mafia, as well as associates of Texas big shots such as Senator Lloyd Benson and Houston power broker Walter Mischer. Well, obviously, this is an explosive story, and today we are going to explore the full ramifications of the SNL crisis with author Pete Bruton, who's now a law student here at the University of Texas.
Pete, this is such an incredible story, one that is so complex, it seems to me almost one impossible to tell, but you do it so well in your book. Before we get into the intricacies of it, I wonder if you can tell us how George Bush himself was involved in this. His family was, but was he himself involved much?
Bush's role was on many levels. First of all, as vice president during the Reagan-Bush years, he was the head of the Reagan-Bush deregulation efforts across the board, and that included savings and loans. And the deregulation of savings and loans that occurred primarily in 1982 with the St. Germain-Garn bill basically opened up savings and loans to the crooks. SNLs had traditionally just done home mortgage lending to middle-class Americans and they succeeded very well for 50 years. They had some problems then in the late 70s and early 80s with the inflation, so the Reagan-Bush administration and Congress decided that they were going to deregulate, quote-unquote, savings and loans. And this allowed SNLs to basically invest their money and lend their money on anything they wanted to, and was an open invitation to the criminal element. And sure enough, the mafia was one of the first people, groups involved in looting SNLs in the early 80s. And the deregulation that Bush was in charge of did that. Bush also, as vice president, either he or his top aides intervened in the federal regulation of the biggest failed savings loan in the country at that time, Sunrise Savings in Boynton Beach, Florida. The CEO of Sunrise went up to Bush's office when he was vice president, and the story varies. He tells one story one time and one story another. He either met with Bush, with Bush's top aides, included C. Boyden Gray, who is the current White House counsel. And he asked them to get the federal regulators off his back. They were trying to stop Sunrise from basically throwing their assets away. And 1 week after he met with these people, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board that regulates savings and loans withdrew a very stringent cease and desist order against Sunrise and replaced it with a weak supervisory agreement. And a congressional study found that this move cost taxpayers possibly $100 million or more in keeping Sunrise open. Sunrise was then closed down a year and a half later, at a cost to the federal taxpayers of $700 million. And there was no Federal Home Loan Bank Board investigation. It was just shut down. We find if you look at the major borrowers at Sunrise, you find mafia people, you find CIA people, and you find a Houston businessman named John Riddle, who he ties into the circle of Houston businessmen that George Bush comes from. And Riddle, at this time, was involved in the transshipment of arms to the Middle East. Now, the top number two official at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, Ann Fairbanks, was in this meeting with the Sunrise CEO, when he was asking them to get the feds off his back. Her husband, Richard Fairbanks, was in charge at that time of the State Department's efforts to keep arms from Iran, called Operation Staunch. He quit a year later and became the Washington lawyer and lobbyist for Iraq, and worked with Iraq until Iraq invaded Kuwait. Now, it's interesting also to note that the largest failed SNL in the country that did not have a Federal Home Loan Bank Board investigation, Sunrise was number two largest. The largest was Hill Financial in Red Hill, Pennsylvania, that plays a big part in my book. And the number two borrower at Hill Financial was John Riddle's buddy, a Houston builder named Mike Atkinson, who at that time was transshipping arms to the Middle East. So you find a connecting thread here of arms to the Middle East and savings and loans. And Bush's office was directly involved in keeping this Sunrise Savings open, and it was lending money to John Riddle.
It seems like such a complex thing, but it seems everywhere you look, there are certain things going on. The CIA and the Mafia, and there were drugs that were being run back into the United States. There were illegal arms being procured and sent to the Contras, as well as to Iran.
And Iraq, as we now know.
And Iraq. But all of these interests coincided. The Mafia, the... now, how did the Mafia... was the Mafia just after money? Is that how... and perhaps the selling of drugs when they came back into the United States?
I think the Mafia just found it as another, you know, trough they could feed at. And I think they were in on it at the beginning. When they saw, they knew what deregulation was going to do. And the fact that they figured out a scheme. And the head of this scheme was a New York mobster named Mario Renda, mm-hmm. who went to jail for like less than 3 years. He was convicted in New York, Florida, and Kansas City. Renda would collect money from various institutions like pension funds and credit unions, bundle it up into $100,000 bundles so it was covered by federal deposit insurance, and then place it in savings and loans all across the country, billions of dollars. And once he got the money, the deposits into an SNL, he could basically control them. He had a hammer over their head. If they didn't do with this money what he wanted to, he'd just pull it out. And this was called linked financing. He would place the deposits and then tell the SNLs to loan the money, to lend the money to his buddies. They would then just rip it off, take it and rip it off. Now, in Texas, we found a Louisiana mobster named Herman K. Beebe,
yeah.
who was controlling SNLs in a different way than Renda. And we found Beebe and Renda together in many, many different places across the country, many connections between the two. But Beebe would actually finance the purchase of savings and loans by his associates like Don Dixon at Vernon, Carol Kelly at Continental, Jarrett Woods at Western, Roy Daly at First Savings of East Texas. And then he would have a hammer over their head where he was holding the note on their stock to the SNL so they would do what he wanted to.
I think it's so significant what you've pointed out, that this isn't just something, these relationships aren't something which came together suddenly when they said, oh, hey, here's a great big pig, let's cut it up. This was just a continuation of relationships between powerful people at various levels, state, local, and national, that have been going on for some time.
Well, that's correct. In fact, we had a sort of dry run on the SNL scandal in the mid-70s in Texas with the so-called Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal, where we have the same people that showed up in the SNL crisis ripping off small Texas banks and doing the same thing, trading bad loans between each other, trading capital stock loans between each other. And Herman K. Beebe was in the middle of that. Ben Barnes, his business partner, was in the middle of it. And then later, Ben Barnes and John Conley show up as big, big borrowers at many of the dirtiest SNLs in the country. George Albin, another guy that was involved in savings and loans, was in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal. So, and the federal government knew about the Rent-A-Bank scandal. They came in and did an investigation. There was a savings and loan in Texas, in Houston, called Surety, that a woman named Rosemary Stewart was in charge of the federal regulation of in Washington. And she saw Herman K. Beebe, she saw Walter Mischer, she saw Mischer's son-in-law, Robert Corson. And when these people all got back in the SNLs, you know, 5, 10 years later, she did nothing. And she was then in charge of the Office of Enforcement of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board.
Pete, your book begins, in fact, by discussing Walter Mischer, who is a Houston banker and power broker, as a major player in this whole SNL scam. Can you tell a little bit about him and what role he actually played in this scenario?
Yeah, Walter Mischer was at the very center of the Houston business connections that all you take all these SNLs and you start tracking back where the money goes, and you find Mischer and his friends. Mischer was what we call a hyphenated Texan, banker hyphenated developer, and there's probably a few other hyphens in there too. Political power broker. He controlled politicians on all levels. Mischer basically told the Houston developers who they were going to donate political campaign money to. Mischer had the third largest bank in Houston, Allied Bank, and he used Allied Bank to finance many different things, including some of the dirtiest savings and loans in Houston, like Continental Savings, Mainland Savings, and some others. And in fact, Mischer knew that the SNLs were going down the tubes in the early 80s because he sold a savings and loan he had, Ben Franklin Savings, that at one time had belonged to Lloyd Benson's company. He also ordered all the SNL capital stock loans out of Allied in 82, 83, so that when these SNLs failed, he wouldn't be caught holding the bag. And in turn, he had many savings and loans helping he and his bank out indirectly. And one time, Mainland Savings in Houston bought a $20 million loan that Allied held on an oil company. It was in bankruptcy. And a later investigation showed that Mainland lost at least $14 million on this. There was no hope of repaying, and Mainland just did it as a favor to Allied. The CEO of Mainland had his Mainland stock financed at Allied Bank and was a good friend of Walter Mischer.
And what sort of political friends did Walter Mischer have? Who were his main sort of political connections?
Well, Mischer goes back to the old 8F days of the Lamar Hotel in Houston, where the Brown brothers, Jesse Jones, Gus Wortham, these people were wheeling and dealing, controlling Houston, and politicians like Lyndon Johnson. It goes back that far. And then you bring Mischer was very close to John Conley, Ben Barnes, Lloyd Benson, and George Bush. And most of the Houston mayors and Harris County judges, almost all of the Texas governors, except for Ann Richards, I'm not sure about her, but we know Dolph Briscoe and even Republicans like Bill Clements, Mischer was very close to and supported. And Mischer's political donations and influence went to both parties. It was not just Democrats. I mean, he supported Democrats, of course, back in the 50s and 60s when Democrats controlled this state. But he also, you know, controlled and helped a lot of Republicans like John Tower and George Bush and Bill Clinton.
So he was a well-connected fellow.
Very well-connected, and not just, of course, to politicians. He was connected to the mafia, was a big shock. I mean, when I was reporting the Houston Post and people started telling me about his connections to the mafia, we did a big interview with him, and it was on the cover of the Houston Post Sunday magazine. And I asked him, what about all the rumors about your connections to Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans mafia boss? And he admitted that he had sat down to do business with Marcello. At one time, Marcello had come in and wanted to buy a couple of his hotels, including the Carousel Hotel on the South Loop. And he said he did not sell them to him because he did not want to get, quote, run out of town. Well, it turns out when you investigate who he really sold it to, it turns out to be a Marcello frontman and associate. So he really did, and Mischer and his partners kept the deed, the title, to this hotel, while Marcello's frontman was showing the X-rated movies and running prostitutes in this hotel.
And what about H.K. Beebe? His connections with Walter Mischer and the mob.
Yeah, well, Beebe, the New Orleans, the Louisiana mafia associate from Shreveport, had turned up first in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal, where he was connected to Ben Barnes, who of course was in Walter Mischer's hip pocket. Beebe then was borrowing money from Mishra's Allied Bank. Mishra was supporting him, making him operating loans, giving him insurance business. And in one case, the stock of Continental Savings in Houston was financed at Mishra's Allied Bank with a guarantee from Herman K. Beebe. So they were very close and doing business not only in the Houston area, but in Louisiana. We find associates of Mishra, very close associates, including the former controller of the currency, Robert Clark, going in and buying a bank with Herman K. Beebe in Louisiana, along with the two top executives at Mishra's bank.
Now, was Beebe under Marcello?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this had been determined actually by the Texas Attorney General's Organized Crime Strike Force in the mid-70s. John Hill has actually had an organized crime investigative unit headed by, I believe, Tim James. And they found the connections between Herman K. Beebe and Carlos Marcello. Beebe was also tied to Marcello by the New Orleans Metropolitan Crime Commission. This is back in the mid-70s. And then you find all of the connections then later with the SNL scandal.
Can you give us an example of how the mafia comes in with the mob, loots a savings and loan or two, and then move on?
Well, they would, in Beebe's case, he would actually finance the controlling stock of an SNL, and then the loans would be made to either Beebe or his associates, and then they would take the money and walk the loans, and leaving the SNL with property that wasn't worth any what they'd lent on it. And that's the way they'd basically fail.
How did the CIA get involved then with these people?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think we know the final answer yet. There are some people that believe that William Casey had been in on the beginning of the deregulation and knew that it was susceptible. You know, Casey was an old Wall Street lawyer and head of the SEC at one time, and knew that the SNLs were very vulnerable to being looted and the money taken out and never found. But on the other hand, we have people like Walter Mishra, who are connected to the CIA, can probably see that if they keep the CIA happy, you know, diverting some of the money to CIA operations, then, you know, they will get what the FBI calls the CIA's get-out-of-jail-free card. In other words, if they're working, doing, and helping the CIA and they get caught, then the CIA can come in and say, don't prosecute this person. He's working with us. And that happened on a number of occasions in the SNL crisis, where we would have a savings and loan looter or a bank looter getting caught by the FBI and the Justice Department, the CIA trying to get them off the hook because they work with them.
Now, we've had on Alternative Views, those of you who've been watching Alternative Views regularly know that about the drug scams which were going on, where illegal arms would be shipped down to the Contras particularly, and the C-130s would be filled up with cocaine and all and brought back in the United States and offloaded, sometimes at U.S. Air Force bases, sometimes at more covert landing strips. Now, how would this operation fit in with what we're talking about?
Right. We found a number of people in Florida that were helping the Contras, taking weapons, guns for drugs, that were involved in failed banks and savings and loans. One CIA gun and drug runner was a guy named Jack DeVoe. And DeVoe was actually bringing in his cocaine into the Ocean Reef Club on Key Largo that was owned by Carl Lindner, the Cincinnati businessman.
Oh, and he's very close to Bush.
Very close to Bush. Okay, Bush would go down and actually vacation at the Ocean Reef Club. And there's a picture in my book of Bush in a fishing boat off Ocean Reef. And this is where Jack DeVoe was bringing in his cocaine. And DeVoe was also taking guns down to Latin America for the CIA. Now, DeVoe's money launderer was a Miami attorney named Lawrence Freeman. Freeman had previously worked for Paul Helliwell, one of the founding fathers of the CIA, and also was laundering money for Santo Traficante, the Tampa, Florida mafia boss. Freeman drew up the documents, the sales contract for a 21,000-acre land deal in the Florida Panhandle that Hill Financial Savings, the one in Pennsylvania we previously talked about, and Vision Bank Savings in Kingsville, Texas, that was owned by Walter Mischer's former son-in-law, financed. And here we have Lawrence Freeman drawing up the papers and involved with these people. And he's, you know, closely connected to the CIA. He had been the in-house counsel for Castle Bank and Trust in Nassau, a bank that was used by the mafia and the CIA to hide and launder money, and was shut down when Paul Helliwell died. And it appeared that many of these offshore money laundering operations were moved after Castle Bank failed and was shut down to the Isle of Jersey. And Lawrence Freeman was laundering Jack DeVoe's drug money through the Isle of Jersey. Robert Corson, Mischer's former son-in-law, and Mike Atkinson were laundering SNL money through the Isle of Jersey, along with some people in Colorado that connect to Neil Bush. All were using the same trust on the Isle of Jersey were getting drug money and SNL money, and they were mixed in the same bank accounts.
Pete, could you give some examples of how the CIA would loot SNLs and what they'd use the money for?
Well, it's not like the CIA would you'd get a loan from an SNL and down the bottom line, you know, for guns to the Contras.
Signed by the CIA.
Right. That's not the way they operate. I mean, they use cutouts in front people so that to maintain their plausible deniability, so that they can come in and deny that it wasn't them.
And what's a cutout then?
A cutout is a front man, a middle person who may not even know he's working for the CIA. I think there could be four or five levels of cutouts and front men, the layers that the CIA would, the money would flow through so that it couldn't be tracked back to the CIA. One of the best examples we have in the SNLs was when Mainland Savings, this is the SNL that Walter Mischer was financing the stock of. This is the SNL whose chairman of the board, Raymond Hill, was a close and longtime friend of James A. Baker III. White House Chief of Staff, former Treasury Secretary, former Secretary of State, George Bush's best friend. When Mainland failed, James Baker's old law firm, Andrews and Kurth, in Houston, was brought in by the feds to investigate the failure and file a lawsuit against the officers and directors to try to recover the lost money. Andrews and Kurth investigated, actually drew up a lawsuit, a petition, but was never filed. It was stopped at the top layers of Andrews Kurth and the federal government. And as a result, no lawsuit was ever filed against Raymond Hill, the Mainland CEO, and no money was ever recovered. No indictments have ever been filed against anybody in the failure of Mainland Savings. Okay, so here we have this SNL. It's wired in to Walter Mischer and James Baker. In the summer of 1985, James Baker went before a Senate Finance Committee as Treasury Secretary and told them that there was nothing to worry about in the SNLs. Everything was wonderful and fine, and nothing bad was going to happen. At the very same time, Mainland Savings was entering into a $68 million land deal with Adnan Khashoggi, a Saudi Arabian middleman and arms dealer. And it was a very complicated deal. The result of it was that Khashoggi walked away with about $16 million in cash profit, pure profit from this land deal. The taxpayers later got stuck with about a $50 million loss on this deal. This was closed. This deal was closed and the money transferred on August the 1st, 1985. 6 days later, Adnan Khashoggi begins the transfer of $5 million to Ghobanifar, the Iranian middleman, to start the first publicized arms for hostages deal. It's interesting that he transferred $5 million to Ghobanifar because at the same time, Mainland was basically giving him $16 million. They also gave him a $5 million letter of credit that was very strange because it could only be drawn on in the first week in November of 85. And it had all the earmarks of a guarantee. And in fact, later, when Khashoggi's people were trying to cover this up from the FBI, who caught on to this pretty soon, they said it was to guarantee some stock that Khashoggi had bought from Mainland. But the money to buy that stock had come from Mainland in this deal. In other words, Mainland gave Khashoggi $10 million. He gives it back to them in exchange for $10 million in stock. And they said, oh, by the way, here's a letter of credit for $5 million to guarantee this stock. It didn't make any sense at all because it came from Mainland. The money came from Mainland, but the $5 million matches exactly the $5 million that Khashoggi paid Gabbana for.
So, Pete, this is, in a sense, the beginning of Iran-Contra.
Yes.
That's funded with SNL money. So and one of the reasons why Baker and Bush and the U.S. government was not regulating the SNLs, was not doing something about this crisis that was emerging, is because they were using the SNLs to finance some of their off-the-book activities they didn't want Congress or the public to look into. Is that a correct
thing? I think that's ultimately what happened. Now, whether we can prove that they, quote, used them, we'll probably never know, but that is the ultimate upshot of what happened. And the money, of course, from Maimon ultimately came from the American taxpayers. So we, in a sense, were financing these covert illegal operations. And it's the way that, of course, Oliver North and William Casey, it's the way that George Bush, the way they like to do things. I mean, North testified before Congress that what William Casey was looking for and trying to set up was a self-sustaining, off-the-shelf, self-financing, covert operation. And here we had it. We see it in operation with the savings and loan money that ultimately came from the American taxpayer. So, Khashoggi wasn't out any money. The Iranians and Israelis really weren't out any money. It came from the American taxpayers.
Incredible.
Now, in so much of what we've talked about previously in Alternative Views and in a lot of the news stories that you would read, they would mainly focus on the savings and loans themselves and all these wheelers and dealers like Don Dixon up in Vernon Savings or Charles Keating and all of that. But we're talking about a stratum above that, those people, aren't we?
Oh, definitely. I think Dixon and Keating and all the others, Ed McBurney, Jarrett Woods, Tyrell Barker, were just front men. I mean, they were cutouts, basically. And if you look at how much money they got, I call them one or two percenters. Dixon got maybe, $20 million out of Vernon? I mean, he himself. And Vernon is costing taxpayers over $1 billion. Keating got about $40 million. And Lincoln Savings is costing taxpayers $2 billion. So you can see you're getting 1% or 2%. And it's a classic front man setup. And the people that you have to, who's really getting this money? And you start scratching and digging, you find that you're in another stratum, as you say, of businessmen who are connected to the politicians very strongly. Of course, Keating had strong connections too, but if you look at who got the money out of Lincoln, you find John Connally and Ben Barnes getting close to $100 million. You find a little bank in Paris called Saudi European.
Paris, Texas.
Paris, France.
Paris, France.
Yes. It connects into the BCCI.
Oh, I see.
And Keating was investing money in that. And you start scratching and digging, you find even bigger players than Keating behind this.
So then there's that. Now this layer is the layer of the mafia and the CIA. And was there another layer above them? Like the big banks, they were getting the money, the benefits of the money laundering from drugs, because they would be laundered through the U.S. big banking system.
Well, that's correct.
Were they also benefiting from this at a same level or higher level?
Well, the banks and insurance companies, believe it or not, were some of the big institutions that got bailed out by the SNLs. If you had a piece of property or an office building, the first mortgage or the first lien on it might be held by a big bank or a big insurance company. And when the savings and loan would come in and take out everything and refinance the whole deal, the banks and SNLs would get paid off by the savings and loan. In fact, that happened in the Khashoggi deal. Texas Commerce Bank had a $15 million mortgage against Khashoggi's property. And the money to pay off that mortgage came from Mainland Savings and also Lamar Savings in Austin joined in that. So Texas Commerce Bank got all their money back from the savings and loans. You find it happen time and time again. A piece of property will have a first mortgage by a bank or insurance company that will get paid off by the SNL when they take the whole deal out.
Well, as I understand, the big banks, I mean the Wall Street banks and all, a lot of these deals, a lot of the property would be resold, and eventually they would come up into the hands of these bigger banks and insurance companies like in New York. And so I guess they would be the first ones to be paid off in any type of bailout, would they not?
Well, sure. I mean, if they're holding the first mortgage, they're going to get the money first before anybody. And the savings loan might be holding a third or fourth mortgage. I mean, they would wrap these things and flip these things so that the S&L might be third or fourth in line and would never get, once the property sold and the first mortgagee is paid off, the S&L is left with nothing.
Pete, there's a chapter of your book called The Mobsters, Spooks, and George Bush, the Palmer National Bank story, that ties all these things that we're talking about together. In other words, the way that high-level officials with connections to the government, corporate and political officials, formed a bank, the Palmer National Bank, and how it became connected with all these unsavory operations. Do you want to give us some detail on this to sort of concretely illustrate this analysis?
Yeah, Palmer National Bank had just about everybody in it. It was a small bank, still exists in Washington, D.C., about two blocks north of the White House. It was started by a Louisiana businessman named Harvey McLean and a political operative in Washington, D.C. called Stephen Halper. And McLean and Halper met in 1980 when they were both working on George Bush's presidential campaign. And Halper later was head of the policy group for Bush. And then when Reagan became the nominee and Bush was named vice presidential candidate, Halper went to work for their campaign as part of the policy group and was actually a high-level official in what they called the October Surprise Group, a group that was trying to determine whether or not Carter was going to pull off an October surprise and get the Iranian hostages home or whatever. And Halper was in charge of this group. His father-in-law was Ray Klein, who was the former deputy director of intelligence of the CIA. Klein was working with them, with Bush. And then when Reagan and Bush won, Halper went to work for the State Department. They created a position for him. And James Baker, by the way, was the one that brought Halper over to the Reagan-Bush team after Reagan became the nominee from the Bush team. So, and Harvey McLean was a businessman from Shreveport, Louisiana, and he was being financed by none other than Herman K. Beebe, the mafia associate. McLean moves to Dallas and buys Paris Savings Loan in Paris, Texas, and is borrowing money from Vernon Savings, from Continental Savings in Houston. And later, of course, all these loans go bad and Paris goes bust. And McLean's business deals cost taxpayers probably over $100 million. That's kind of getting ahead of the story. Back in 83, McLean and Halper are taking a trip to China and they start talking about, let's get a bank in Washington, D.C. And so they start Palmer National Bank. Palmer was named after McLean's grandmother and daughter. And the capital, the $3 million capital to start the bank, came from Herman K. Beebe and Bossier Bank and Trust.
The Beebe's guy bank. Connected to the mob in Louisiana.
Right.
He seems to be everywhere.
And to Mischer, and to Ben Barnes, John Connolly, all these people. As soon as they start this bank, they begin lending money to conservative Republican PACs like Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. And then they take on another client, the National Endowment for the Preservation of Liberty, which was started by Oliver North and a guy named Spitz Channel to funnel private donations to the Contras. Okay, and of course the biggest donor was Ellen Garwood here in Austin, the widow of the former Supreme Court Justice. And Palmer National Bank was also lending money to the National Endowment for operating loans and for furniture loans, and helping funnel the money. That's where they had the bank. The money would go from Palmer National Bank to another Washington bank to the Cayman Islands and then over to Geneva, Switzerland, in the bank account at Credit Suisse, where not only was contra money being flowed into, but Iranian arms profits were also
being... Secord was operating.
Yes, that was Secord's. And then it would go out to the Contras. And Palmer was the starting point of the money. And Palmer National Bank also made a loan on a beach house in Solano Beach, California, that B.B. and Dixon would use to entertain S&L regulators, including L.L. Bowman. In fact, that's where he allegedly had a tryst with a prostitute in that beach house. And Palmer National Bank had a piece of the action on that beach house. And later, Stefan Halpert was, when he got caught in the Debategate scandal, if you recall that, the theft of the Carter debating manuals that ended up in the Reagan-Bush campaign that apparently James Baker or William Casey or both of them were involved in.
And that was just part of an enormous covert action against the Carter administration, which they had something like 137 operatives at all kinds of high levels, spying, snooping, and even stealing top secret documents. And this is just one of their operations.
That's correct. Well, Halper was involved in that. And he, of course, his name surfaced in 1984 when this came out, and he had to sort of leave. He kind of backed out of Palmer National Bank. But he stayed in touch with these people, of course. And then when Oliver North was fired by Reagan in November 1986, when the scheme where they were, you know, using profits from the Iranian arms deals to fund the Contras, and all came tumbling out, and Reagan fired North, the very last entry in Oliver North's White House diaries was legal defense firm - Stefan Halper, our old Palmer National Bank guy.
Who also, again, I want to make this October Surprise connection, because Halper was the head of the October Surprise Committee for the Reagan election team in 1980, which was frightened to death that the Carter administration was going to negotiate the release of the hostages, which may be one of the reasons why they stole the debate book, as well as did these other covert actions against Carter, because they wanted to find out what he was doing for this hostage release, and if possible, subvert it and give the Iranians a better deal. At least that's the account that Gary Sick and others give.
That's correct. And that was in the middle of it.
And how it worked out that way. They rigged a deal so that the Iranians would hold the hostages until after the election and in return for arms. And lo and behold, 20 minutes after Reagan raised his hand and said that he would ruin the country, the hostages were released.
Well, and here we have this little bank, you know, that was involved in all this being financed with Louisiana mafia money. And when Herman K. Beebe was first convicted in 1985, of course, they moved that loan out of Bossier Bank to a little savings and loan in Beaumont, Texas, called San Jacinto Savings, different from San Jacinto in Houston. And if you look at the board members of that bank, you find two people who were major stockholders in the casinos, Caesars Casino in Las Vegas, that of course was being skimmed by the Chicago Mafia at that time.
So it's absolutely incredible how all this is connected. October Surprise, Iran-Contra, SNL, Mafia, CIA, all of William Casey, all of these operations under the Reagan administration were interconnected, as well as the players.
That you find the same people and the same threads running through these operations, and the money, you know, from SNL is going into these operations.
Wow. Can you tell us another story about a landing strip in Lajitas, Texas?
Yes. I first found out about the possible connections to the savings and loans and the CIA in, I guess, the fall of 1988, when a woman in Houston called up my associate at the Houston Post, Greg C., and told him, berated him about some of our coverage of SNL's that weren't getting the whole story. So we went to see her. Her name was Rebecca Sims. She had been Robert Corson, Mishra's former son-in-law, his accountant. And she had quit because she'd been asked to commit bankruptcy and tax fraud. And so she started investigating Corson. And she found out that Corson had been an asset of the CIA. And when she first told me that, I really wasn't interested in it at all. I had no interest in it. I wasn't looking for the CIA. I was looking for the mafia. And I guess I was even a little disappointed. But when I went back to my office, I remembered several things. One, when we had done the story on Walter Mischer and had been calling everybody, all his people he knew, just to get background information on him, one of his close associates told me about the 700,000 acres in Belize, in Central America, that he had bought into, and that his associate thought that this was a CIA operation. And this was someone who's very close to Mischer and would not say something like that unless he knew it had something to do. And I sort of filed that, you know, away in my mind. I remembered that came up, and then I remember there was a organized crime strike force prosecutor in Kansas City that was chasing Mario Renda, the New York mob money broker. And I was chasing Renda too, so we had a lot of contact. I'd been sending him our stories we'd been writing in the Houston Post. And he said almost the same thing Rebecca Sims had said, you're missing something big here, there's something you're not getting. And so I wondered if he was talking about the CIA. So I flew out to Kansas City and met with him, and sure enough, that was it. He was talking about the CIA. So that's how the CIA connection arose. And Rebecca Sims had been told about the CIA connection from a man named Richard Brennecke.
Oh, my gosh. His name pops up in
October Surprise, Drugs.
Brennecke had been the sort of renegade intelligence agent in Portland, Oregon. He had received a lot of notoriety because some of the breaking stories on Iran-Contra had come from him, on the Iranian arms deals and some of the Contra arms deals. And the New York Times and Newsweek had used him as a major source. And so I went up to see Brennecke, and I spent a week with him. And when I got back, I really didn't have much, because Brennecke didn't have a lot of documents backing up what he was saying. It was a very frustrating experience with Brennecke. I mean, he's a typical kind of intelligence agent that will deliberately lie to you on some occasions. I mean, you just can't trust everything he tells you. But on the other hand, he will tell you the truth on a number of occasions. And he, at one point in our conversations, began describing a landing strip in far west Texas that had been a CIA guns for drugs deal. Guns and drugs transshipment point. And he said they flew C-130s in and out of there. It was a 4,000 foot. So I ripped a big sheet of paper out of my legal notebook, and I said, draw me a map. So he starts drawing this map, and here was Lajitas, which is west of Big Bend. He said, about 10 miles northeast, and there's this mesa. And he had a very detailed map, 4,000. He gave me the way it was oriented, the fact that there was a mountain just north of it, and there was a mesa there. And so I took that back to Houston with me, hoping, maybe this would check out. So I got a USGS Class A topo map of the area, which I was absolutely positive would show a landing strip that big, 4,000 feet. And I get the map out, and I look at it, and I can see about where it should have been according to his map, and there was nothing on the map. And so I said, well, I'll give it one more shot. I'll get the aerial photographs that they use to make these maps. They take aerial photographs. And so I ordered the aerial photographs, and I got them out, and I looked at them, and there it was, right exactly where the landing strip, exactly where he described it. And the FAA had no record of this. It wasn't on any map. And so I went out to that, it's about 15 miles northeast of Lajitas, and about less than 10 miles from Terlingua, and actually drove out to it and looked at it and began talking to people about it, and basically got it confirmed that it was a C-130s flew in there with arms and drugs. And Brennecke had told me that when he flew in there, that he asked the people he was flying in there with, who were people, by the way, associated with the Medellin cartel, whose landing strip this was. He was told it was Walter Mischer. Now, Mischer owns, at that time, it owned probably close to 300,000, maybe more acres in that area, but he didn't own that piece of property. He had land to the west of it and land to the south of it. So when I began researching who owned this property, I found a widow in Florida actually owned that property, and she had never been there in her life, and only found out a few years before I talked to her that a landing strip was there because one of her relatives went hunting and told her, did you know there's a landing strip right in the middle of your property? And she said, no. And she said it was done without her knowledge or permission. And of course, it was actually the only place in that area. That's a very rough, rugged country there. Just west of Big Bend. It was the only level place for miles and miles around in that vicinity that you could put a landing strip. And, of course, if a widow from Florida who's never been there owns it, and just about anybody wanted to probably could go. Of course, the law enforcement had to know about it. When you talk to them, you get contradictory answers and inconsistent answers, and they're trying to cover up, obviously, although they would acknowledge that they'd seen C-130s in the vicinity. There's no reason for C-130. Of course, there is a low-level training route for C-130s out of San Antonio in that area. What a perfect cover, of course, for flying in C-130s.
Can we get up to a higher level of politics again? Mr. Benson, Lloyd Benson, he's connected with this in some way.
Yeah, I ran into Benson in a number of places. The first place I ran into Lloyd Benson was in Jefferson Savings, which was in the Rio Grande Valley, I believe in McAllen. Jefferson Savings had been started by Lloyd Benson and his brother and Benson's father back in the mid-50s. And they controlled it up until the mid-70s when they sold it to a man named Guillermo Hernandez Cartaya. Cartaya is one of the really bad boys of the Western Hemisphere. he's a Cuban exile, fought in the Bay of Pigs, was a member of the infamous 2506 Brigade, had been involved in narcotics trafficking, money laundering, gun running, terrorist activities out of Florida with a company called World Finance. The IRS and the FBI had close to 200 people investigating World Finance in the mid-70s, and Alt was ready to pop Cartaya big when the CIA stopped them and came in and basically had the investigation dismantled. And as a result, Cartaya was just convicted on income tax charges. At that very same time, he comes and buys Jefferson Savings from the Benson family, okay, and proceeds to loot it and run drug money through it. When the Justice Department came in to investigate, Cartaya were brought in by the Texas regulators, and Art Leiser, who was the chief S&L examiner for the state of Texas, brought in the feds. The CIA came down and met with the prosecutor and asked him to back off Cartaya because of all the favors Cartaya had done for our government, including, it turns out, scamming about $30 million from a United Arab Emirates bank with the apparent permission of the CIA. And Cartaya, the Justice Department did not back off Cartaya on that deal. He was convicted, but his sentence was rolled into his IRS sentence. And I don't know how many years, he probably only did a couple of years in jail. The next year after that happened, Cartaya was again indicted along with his partner, Camilo Padreira, another Cuban exile in Miami. That indictment was stopped for some reason. The Justice Department said later it was flawed, but if it's flawed, why did they draw it up? Camilo Padreira shows up 10 years later as a partner of Jeb Bush, the president's son in Miami. Now, when I found out about Cartaya and also Jefferson Savings, the fact that Lloyd Benson had, you know, owned part of that, I called up Benson's office to ask him about it. I got his press secretary, Jack DeVore. I asked him questions, you know, what was Benson's role in this S&L, you know, what did he own, did he know Cartaya, et cetera, et cetera. And DeVore said he'd get back to me that the senator was in some conference on the Canary Islands, which is off the coast of Africa. About an hour later, DeVore calls me back and said the senator never owned any stock in this S&L, doesn't know anything about it, never had anything to do with it. I said, are you sure about this? He said, yes, I satisfied myself. He doesn't recall owning anything. I said, well, that's funny. I got a document here from the S&L department that shows he owned 16.7% of the original stock and continued to own it up into the 60s. And these signatures are notarized. He said, well, I'll get back to you. 30 minutes later, I get a call from Lloyd Benson himself from the Canary Islands, saying, oh, yes, he had owned stock in that, but he got out of it in the mid-60s and bought in Brazosport Savings, which later became Continental Savings, okay? And then I asked him about Cartaya, said he knew it. I said, what about the CIA interference? He assured me that hadn't happened because he would have known about it. Well, in fact, I got this story straight from the prosecutor that the CIA went to. And so either Benson lied to DeVore, or DeVore lied to me. There's no other explanation for it. I mean, somebody lied. I mean, they told me a lie, that Benson had never been owned any stock in this SNL. And if I hadn't had that document, they would have gotten away with the lie. Now, it's interesting to note that this SNL that Benson bought after he got out of Jefferson became Continental Savings, and that purchase was financed by Herman K. Beebe. So it's possible that mafia money went to Lloyd Benson. Now, when I asked DeVore about that, he said they didn't know that Beebe was financing Kelly, and so had no knowledge, Carol Kelly, the guy that owned it, whether this was mob money or not. And in fact, it was.
Well, didn't Benson also later, in when he was running as vice president, didn't he put the kibosh on any investigation or statements in any of the debates about the SNLs? Isn't that part of your book, too?
Yes. Well, in 1988, the country knew we had an SNL problem. We didn't know the extent of it. Okay, the original estimates had been something like maybe $10-15 million. The Republicans, of course, with Bush as the candidate, did not bring up the SNL. Bush's son Neil was right in the middle of Silverado Savings, which was about to be taken down. In fact, was taken down only a couple of weeks after the presidential election. Someone in Washington had called the regulators in Topeka, Kansas, that regulated Silverado, and told them not to shut Silverado down until after the presidential election, and that's in fact what happened. On the other side, Benson was the Democratic vice presidential nominee. He went to the Dukakis campaign people and told them not to bring up the SNL crisis, and so they didn't. The Democrats did not use that as an issue, and they could have pounded the Republicans over the head with it.
And maybe won the election in 1988.
Perhaps. And of course, we had the Keating Five. Four of the Keating Five were Democrats. I mean, the Democratic Congress had just as much to answer for as the Republican administration. And so neither side wanted to bring it up. Of course, both sides were being paid off by people like Mischer. I mean, they always cover their bets. The people like Mischer, they support both sides. So regardless of who wins, they've got an end. And George Bush and Lloyd Benson are part and parcel of this same small Houston businessman circle that Walter Mischer is at the middle of, Joe Russo is part of, and a guy named Jim Bath, a CIA operative in Houston, is good friends with George Bush and George Bush's son, George W. Bush, and has done investments for Lloyd Benson and was in business with Lloyd Benson's son. And Bath, of course, ties in with Mischer. He got loans from Mischer's bank. And it's all a very tight little circle here. Bush and Benson are two peas in a pod as far as being controlled and dealing with and have friendship with the same people.
And what about any other connections that Benson might have to the SNL crisis other than him owning this one SNL for 20 years? Did he have investments in or connections with other SNLs who were involved in the crisis, or did he do things as a senator that might be involved in making sure there's no investigations, et cetera?
Well, I don't know if he ever directly intervened, but he certainly didn't push for it. And he was head of the Senate Finance Committee that could have done all sorts of investigations. He never did. I mean, in fact, he did his best to see that the SNL crisis was not brought up. He had three savings and loans at one time that all ended up in the hands of either the mafia or the CIA people. Jefferson Savings went to Cartaya. Continental Savings went to Carol Kelly. It was financed completely by Herman K. Beebe. And Ben Franklin Savings later ended up in the hands of Walter Mischer.
Now, this in and of itself is absolutely incredible, that SNLs or banks or any institution can be sold to mafia-controlled groups. How is this even possible?
Well, it's possible because the people in power either don't know or don't want to know that these are mafia people. I mean, the Justice Department had not done the kind of investigation required. The Federal Home Loan Bank Board wasn't doing investigations, and the press was not reporting. Of course, everybody knew who Beebe was. From the Dallas Morning News wrote about Beebe and the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal, but seemed to forget about it, 10 years later when they're back involved in SNLs. And no one, raised. I mean, we've got Congress not doing anything, we've got the Justice Department not doing anything, we've got the press not doing anything. But the public is not going to find out, and nobody's going to know.
And what did Benson say, that he didn't know that these were mafia connections, that he just sold his interests and someone bought them and he didn't investigate?
Well, I think he knew who he was selling to, but he could say we didn't know the money was coming from the mafia. Well, that's, you know, that's the kind of ignorance we don't need if indeed he didn't know. I mean, it's an ignorance that's almost criminal. I mean, if it's not, he didn't do anything criminal by actually knowing and intending that it happened. His ignorance borders on recklessness.
Pete, we have a lot more questions for you, and we're out of time for this program, but would you like to continue on and do a second program? We want to get into how you got this story and the incredible information that you got and then wove together, and the problems you had in getting stories printed and also getting the book published. Would you stay here and do us the favor of that?
Sure.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. 50 billion here. Me and my boy Felonious Axe gonna take the lyre down to G-Dog's crib in Crawford. The Dickie and Cola gonna bring some freaks too. Gonna have a blast. Billionaires are here, we're men of the hour. We're sitting pretty chillin' in the halls of power. We're buying access, seeing progress, and making a mess of the political process. Oh yes, our cheese is buying us a whole lot of leverage. When we arrive, they serve us a nice cool beverage. We're the final word on the pending legislation. Please don't play your hate it off the regulating of all corporations and our industry. We're the foxes with the platinum set of henhouse keys, buying $1 billion favors for a couple of G's. We got money currency steady blowing in the breeze. We're just living our American dream. The CEOs are playing for the Bush-Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware. Step out or stretch hummus and everybody stands. Parents, lock up your daughters. Here come the billionaires.
The billionaires are in the house.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're dining on pheasant. We're dining on grouse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Dick Cheney worked for us as Halliburton chief exec. Each year we're cutting Dick another $1 million check. These federal contracts just land in our lap. We keep getting away with all the craziest We're ripping off the Pentagon for soldiers' meals. We brought Nigerian officials making energy deals. We say Bush is our president. You know we ain't kidding. He's taking our money and doing our bit. You want to win the game, you got to make the rules. We stole an election right in front of you fools. Our terror alert system got you on your knees while we're picking your pockets and snatching your cheese. We got the USA by its curly short hair, so look out below. Here come the billionaires.
The billionaires are in the house.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're sucking your blood like a bloated louse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Enron is in the house.
In the White House.
Halliburton is in the house.
In the White House.
Fox News Corp is in the house.
In the White House.
ExxonMobil is in the house.
In the White House.
Philip Morris is in the house.
In the White House.
Monsanto is in the house.
In the White House.
This administration's preoccupation is directing the nation on wealth consolidation. All those taxes that you pay, they'll be coming our way upon a platinum trace, so don't play. No one can stop us, no one dares. Run for the hills, here come the billionaires.
And that was The Billionaires Are in the House by Billionaires for Bush. Now we continue with episode 484 of Alternative Views. As with the previous episode, this is from 1992.
We told how Pete analyzed the connection between the CIA and the SNL fraud, and how he discovered that George Bush and his family, unsavory folks connected to the CIA and the mafia, as well as associates of Texas big shots such as Senator Lloyd Benson and Houston power broker Walter Mischer, were all involved in the SNL fraud, which was one of the greatest U.S. financial catastrophes and crimes in our history. Today, however, we're going to talk about how Pete came to break the story, about his experiences as a Houston Post reporter in which he discovered the connections between the SNL and the CIA scandal, how he decided to write a book, his experiences with Simon & Schuster, and how he finally got his book published, and what the response of the book by the media has been.
You've been tracking this SNL thing for a long time. What is the magnitude of the scandal?
Well, we all hear about it. It's going to cost taxpayers about $500 billion. That includes a little over $200 billion of actual losses that the SNLs have incurred that fail, that the taxpayers are going to have to pay back. But when you throw in interest and carrying costs, you get over $500 billion in direct costs. But the other costs are almost as bad. What these fraudulent SNLs did was create an artificial real estate bubble where they inflated real estate values artificially very much, and then the bubble burst. And that sort of spread out, the fallout from that spread to the banks and insurance companies and any other financial institutions that were lending on real estate. And so one of the reasons the banks are in big trouble now is their real estate portfolio. And the larger such a portfolio a bank has, the more trouble it's in. So the effects spread out through the economy in the real estate value. So it's not just $500 billion, which is an incredible hit, but also the indirect real estate effects.
I guess also you could crank into this the amount of money that was skimmed and stolen by all these people was money which did not go into productive resources, so that we're losing out from that aspect also.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think about somebody has estimated that the actual cost when we start paying back to taxpayers is going to be $25 billion a year from now on, forever. Think about what $25 billion every year, what we could have used for that. And then when you think about the money was basically looted and stolen, and that Congress and the Justice Department are not trying to get it back. And that's one of the keys to all this, is tracing the money and also trying to recover it. Now, there's been none of that. I mean, Congress doesn't want to do it because they're involved up to their eyeballs. When you start tracing this money, like you did with the Keating Five, you find it comes in, some of it comes back to their own campaign, chess. And the Justice Department, which is controlled by the president, of course, has not tried to track the money. They're interested in just getting the front men and the cutouts and the middlemen to cop guilty pleas and go to jail maybe for a year or two, and then go on to the next one. So they rack up all these convictions, but they don't try to really figure out what happened and where the money went and who benefited.
Pete, one of the reasons why the government has not done any real prosecution or investigation of this scandal is because they've been involved in it, going all the way to the top up to George Bush. We didn't really get into last time the complicity of George Bush's son, Neil, in a SNL scandal, the Silverado case. Perhaps we can go into that as an illustration of how the SNL scandal worked and the complicity of top establishment officials in this crisis.
Sure. We all know that Neil was a director of Silverado Savings in Denver, Colorado, and that when he was on the board of directors, he was being supported financially by a couple of Denver businessmen named Ken Good and Bill Walters. At the same time, Walters and Good were borrowing huge amounts of money from Silverado. And in fact, Neil got his hand slapped in administrative action for approving loans to his business associate, Bill Walters. What we don't know, what hasn't come out really before, are the connections between not only Good and Walters, but to other Silverado borrowers, to mafia people and to the CIA. And we find that if you look at, say, Bill Walters was the largest borrower at Silverado Savings. He signed on about $130 million of loans. In addition, he sold property to Silverado of about $90 million. Walters was a Denver architect. Walters and his partners, including a guy named Richard Rossmiller, were involved in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal back in the mid-70s with Herman K. Beebe. I mean, Beebe was and Ben Barnes were involved in deals with these people. And Beebe specifically had transferred about $1 million to Richard Rossmiller, Bill Walters' partner. And they had all owned a bank in Marshall, Texas, that was involved in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal. And we find that Walters was also apparently and had been accused of transferring some of his ill-gotten gains to a trust on the Isle of Jersey that was being funneled. Drug money was being laundered through it by people in Miami, and SNL money from people like Robert Corson, the CIA agent, was going through this trust fund. Ken Good, who borrowed over $40 million from Silverado and was Neil Bush's sugar daddy for several years, had also borrowed money from Western Savings in Dallas. It was part of the Herman K. Beebe circle. The biggest company that actually dealt with Silverado was MDC Holdings, whose chief executive is Larry Mizell. Mizell was a big Republican donor. He held fundraisers that George Bush went to. And Mizell had established trust funds done by a Chicago law firm, whose partner was Burton Cantor. Burton Cantor was one of the founding fathers of Castle Bank and Trust, the bank in the Bahamas that the Mafia and the CIA were using. He was involved with CIA projects, Mafia projects in California, and other Mafia figures. And here we have his trust, Larry Mizell's trust fund being set up by Burton Cantor's law firm. And Burton Cantor was also a close associate of Lawrence Freeman, the Miami lawyer who had worked for Paul Helliwell, the CIA founding father, and works for the Mafia, and had been involved in the big Florida land deal that Robert Corson's SNL was funding. So we find this circle. You start pulling on this thread. You look at the people involved in Silverado, and you're back with the Mafia and the CIA.
Now, how did Neil Bush get involved in all of this? What was his initial connection with Silverado? Well, what did he get out of it?
Neil Bush had gone to Denver after getting out of college and was a landman for Amoco, I believe, which meant he went and tried to secure leases so they could drill on the land. And then Bill Walters and Ken Good set him up in his own company. Okay, they were both big Republican donors. Ken Good went to the inauguration party with Neil Bush in Houston in 1988 when Bush won. Bush visited Bill Walters' home in the 1984 campaign. Bill Walters tore up all his brown grass and laid new green grass on his lawn just for George Bush's visit. Okay, they were pumping money into Neil Bush's company that was drilling dry holes in Wyoming, was not making any money. He was being, basically, his salary was being paid by these people. And his company got a big line of credit at Bill Walters' bank. So they were supporting him. Ken Good put him on the board of directors of a Florida company he had and was paying him over $100,000 a year in director's fees. Outrageous. $12,000 a month was going to Neil Bush for just serving on Ken Good's board. They were basically keeping him going.
Protection money, it sounds like.
Well, you know, it's almost, somebody made the analogy that Neil Bush was sort of like the driver of the getaway car. And, the cops weren't going to shoot at the president's son. And so far, all we've had is one indictment. The CEO, Michael Wise, is the only indictment so far on Silverado Savings.
Now, what about Neil Bush and Silverado? What role did he play?
Well, he was
in particular
a director, and he approved loans to his buddy Bill Walters. He also approved loans to the second largest borrower at Silverado was a Houston con man named Etrine Starnes. Starnes borrowed $77.5 million from Silverado 6 months after he donated $30,000 to the Contras and went and had a meeting with Ronald Reagan and Oliver North. And he also borrowed over $25 million from Continental Savings in Houston that was supported by Mafia money from Herman K. Beebe. And Starnes was also involved with John Riddle, the guy who was transshipping arms to the Middle East, and had gotten support from Allied Bank, Walter Mischer's bank. And he turns out to be the second largest borrower at Silverado Savings. So Neil Bush was basically just sitting on the board, almost like a figurehead, but approving these loans and, helping his buddies out.
And getting paid also for it as a director.
Right, that's correct. Although not nearly as much as he got from being a director on Ken Good's company.
Let's talk about how you got this incredible story. Now, your book is, to me, a masterpiece in the sense that everything is so complex. There's so many interconnections and so many layers of activity. And yet you were able to lay it out so that it makes sense and you can follow it.
My first question is, how did you get all this voluminous material and keep track of it?
Well, I've been working on it for over 5 years. I mean, anybody can probably collect that much information in 5 years. You know, I've got 3 4-drawer file cabinets full of documents that support all this information. But, I mean, you just take one step at a time. And when I first started on the SNL story in the spring of 87, and looking at one deal at Mainland Savings in Houston, when it failed in 86, was the largest failure in the country. And you start running into roadblocks and people not talking and can't get documents and nobody's being prosecuted and the money isn't being tracked and nobody's trying to get the money back. Then you start saying something big is going on here and you start pushing. I mean, if we hadn't run into the roadblocks, we might have stopped with that first story. But when you start running it everywhere, people covering up, the government not doing anything, nobody seeming to care where are these billions of dollars went, or care to try to get them back, that's when you start looking. You know you've got a big story. And so you just keep going. I mean, and everywhere I looked, I found something. It was like, I mean, being in the oil business, everywhere you dig a hole, you hit oil. I mean, every rock you turn over, something scurries out from under it. And it was a wonderful story in that sense.
Well, you even have, I mean, you, divorce decrees were significant. Things
yes.
like this.
Yeah, well, you know, the documents at the SNLs are not public. The loan documents, where the money went, the closing documents, the public can't get them. Reporters cannot get them. We cannot track the money. We don't have subpoena power. So the things you rely on are lawsuits and deed records, basically. And so divorce lawsuits are very... They have a lot of good information in them.
Pete, let's go into the history of how you actually came to write this book, starting with your first stories with the Houston Post.
In the spring of 86, I was working on stories involving charitable foundations and hospitals that were not doing enough services for the poor. And a business reporter at the Post named Greg C. got an anonymous call from a guy that we dealt with for over 2 years. And his nickname was DT, which was, you know, short for deep throat. And for a long time, we didn't even know who he was. Well, this guy calls up Greg and tells him that he should start investigating Mainland Savings and its deals with a man named Howard Pulver. So Greg starts doing this, and we eventually found out Pulver and his partners had over 300 companies, and they were doing deals with Mainland all over Houston. And Greg just found himself drowning in a sea of records. There were thousands and thousands of pages of records in the real property records of Harris County on these deals with Mainland. So I was asked just to come help him sort out the records. And we did that, and then we went and interviewed Raymond Hill, the chief executive officer of Mainland Savings. And Hill's attitude was the most arrogant that I've ever encountered in my career as a reporter. And basically, he accused us at one point of stumbling in the same direction as the FBI. And I knew I had a big story, just the way he was acting, like, we can't touch him. And sort of really thumbing his nose at us, that I knew that there was a big story there. And we immediately ran into the mafia. When we were trying to track the deal with Howard Pulver, who lived in Kings Point, Long Island, outside New York. And his partners were all from New York City. They came down and took close to $100 million out of Mainland Savings, left them with promissory notes that were worth, you know, probably less than $10 million. A huge ripoff, and contributed greatly to the failure of Mainland Savings. At the same time he was doing this, Mario Renda was brokering money into Mainland. In fact, there was an indictment in Brooklyn by the Organized Crime Strike Force talking about the money Mario Renda was skimming off of his deposits and placing in various SNLs, and one of them was Mainland. So we knew we had something bigger. We went up to New York City, and we found Renda's partner in this was a guy named Martin Schwimmer, who was also laundering money for the Lucchese mafia family. Okay, when we went to talk to Howard Pulver and to Martin Schwimmer, we found they lived across the street from each other in Kings Point, New York, which is a very wealthy suburban enclave on the north shore of Long Island, very exclusive. And so here we had Schwimmer pumping maybe $100 million in deposits into Mainland, and the guy who lives across the street from him taking about $100 million out the back door. And so we knew we had something very big then. And then we started tracking Renda, and then we heard about Herman K. Beebe, the Louisiana Mafia associate who was involved in all the failed Texas SNLs. We started tracking Beebe, and then we find Beebe and Renda together at so many different places. I mean, here's a New York Mafia associate and a Louisiana Mafia associate, both at the same places, the same times across the country. So, you know, we knew that there was a big, big story here.
Were you shocked or surprised to see that the Mafia was active in looting these SNL banks in Texas? Or had you studied organized crime before?
Just on a couple of occasions we'd run into it. I mean, the myth is there's no organized crime in Texas. And it's wrong. It's just flat wrong. There are a couple of small indigenous Mafia families in Texas, but no big Mafia family. But Texas is basically under the aegis of the Louisiana, the Carlos Marcello Mafia family, and there's a lots of Mafia activity in Texas. I mean, of course, anytime you have people like the Texas oil men that naturally like to gamble. I mean, the way the Mafia gets their foot in the door and their fingers into a community, a new community, is through gambling. I mean, that's the way they do it. And of course, oil men naturally love, anybody who likes to gamble has got all that money. I mean, they're going to have to, if you bet big on anything illegally, you're dealing with the Mafia, probably whether you know it or not. And if you don't pay up, you're going to find out in a hurry.
There's a price you pay.
Yeah, and that we found that if you look at all the congressional crime committees and their studying of Carlos Marcello, you find in one case where he was talking to a Houston oil man named Josie in one case. And we find John Meekum Jr., the Houston oil man, dealing with the Marcellos. So, I mean, you find them in Texas and dealing with a lot of the big wheeler dealers and power brokers.
The story was running in the Houston Post, but I've noticed in studying local power structures in the media that usually the local media don't take on or expose any of the activities of local power brokers. But you were writing about Mischer.
Well, I was writing about him, but none of the stories on Mischer are running. Okay.
All this. Paper censored.
Yeah. When we had done, we spent 2 years working on the Mafia, and then we found out about the CIA, and I spent another year working on the CIA, and that's when I ran into Mischer's former son-in-law, Robert Corson, and then all the connections, when I started looking at Mischer, the connections of Mischer to the SNL players. And that took me about a year to do, and in the fall of 1989, we were ready to run with the CIA SNL stories. And Walter Mischer, of course, was in the center of it. And his story, the story about him, was scheduled to lead it off. I mean, because he's the glue that holds all this together. And it's very difficult to understand the story without Walter Mischer. Now, there may be somebody above Mischer telling him what to do. And I was told by a couple of people in Houston that there is indeed. But I was never able to identify that person, if indeed that person exists. But Mischer is the key middleman, the key broker of all the deals. And without him, it's very difficult to understand these stories. The stories were scheduled to run in the winter of 1989. We sent them over to the Houston Post law firm, Fulbright and Jaworski, to read for libel. They sort of read all the stories for libel and try to give us advice. Usually they had the authority, although they shouldn't have, to kill stories that they thought might get us into libel trouble. Well, Fulbright and Jaworski went through the ceiling on Mischer. They immediately reacted and said, we can't run this stuff, and gave a lot of bogus reasons for not doing so. So we began in February of 1990 to run the CIA stories, but nothing on Mischer. We had Corson, we had a Kansas City guy named Farhad Azima, we had a little savings and loan in Lano called Peoples that was lending money to CIA people in Florida. We had Silverado Savings and San Jacinto. We ran all these these stories, but nothing on Mishra. And we ran out of stories eventually in the summer of 1990.
It must have been difficult to write your story with the main actor not being able to.
Very difficult. And most of the national media reacted negatively. I mean, they did not pick up the story. They said, you know, it was too hard to understand and a lot of other reasons. I think, and also the Houston Post is to blame for one thing, for not running a big series. They would just have one story and wait several weeks and run another one and wait. And I think it's just because they were afraid of the story. You know, they were afraid, you know, they just kind of wanted to stick their little foot in the water and see if it got bit off and then run another one if it didn't. And so they were released sporadically, and there was no mystery in it. So a lot of the national media did not pick up. I don't know if we'd run them as a series and had mystery whether it had any more impact. It's difficult to tell. Yeah. The national media really handles the CIA with kid gloves. And we can talk about that later, why, if you'd like to. But anyway, we'd run out of stories, so I went back to the Mishra stuff, and I tried to get that in again. And the editors signed off on it. They approved it. I thought I'd met all of Fulbright and Jaworski's objections. They were scheduled to run in the last of December of 1990. And then at the very last moment, Fulbright and Jaworski refused to sign off on the stories. The editors, even though the city editor wanted to run them and really recommended running them over Fulbright and Jaworski's objections, the editor-in-chief decided not to do the Mishra stories. Now, during this period, I was at my folks' ranch. It was Christmas time. I was talking to the city editor, and the Fulbright and Jaworski associate that was handling the Mishra stuff was a guy named Tom Godbold. And I was talking on the phone with the city editor and said, Godbold won't sign off on him. I was furious, and I said, you know, his job's probably on the line. I bet he won't get made partner if he doesn't kill these stories. You know, I was just talking. I was mad. Well, 6 weeks later, I'd taken a leave of absence to work on the book, and I had lunch with the city editor. And he looked at me and he said, guess what? Godbold just got made partner.
And that's Fulbright and
Jaworski. So that's when I started looking for conflicts of interest. Now, a year and a half earlier, when Godbold was objecting to all the Mishra stuff, I directly asked him, does Fulbright and Jaworski have any conflicts of interest with these stories? And he said, not that I know of. Okay, when I found close to a dozen conflicts of interest, including the fact that Fulbright and Jaworski was representing Mishra's company in a wrongful death lawsuit. At the same time, they were telling us we couldn't run these stories about Walter Mishra. In addition, they were also doing other things for Mishra, as well as doing legal things for Palmer National Bank, this bank in Washington, D.C. They had represented Howard Pulver's company in an insurance deal, and on. And they had laundered money for the CIA, basically, through the MD Anderson Foundation. And conflict after conflict I dug up on Fulbright and Jaworski. Now, I went to the Houston Post. I told them about these conflicts, and the Houston Post did nothing. And so I knew that I could not go back to work with the Houston Post if I'm going to have to run everything through Fulbright and Jaworski, who was serving as the ultimate editors on all these stories.
So was it at this time you decided to go the book route, that you'd resign from the Houston Post and try to write this up as a book?
Well, actually, it had happened earlier. During the middle of the stories I was writing for the Post in the summer of 1990, Simon & Schuster came to me, actually approached me, with an idea of writing a book for them. Simon Schuster is either the first or second largest publishing company in this country, and very prestigious. And they flew me up to New York City and rolled out the red carpet and made me a very big offer to write the book for them.
$100,000
advance, which is probably bigger than any advance on a savings and loan book that's been written. And so we began negotiating a contract, and I was insistent at the very beginning, that the book be published before the 1992 presidential election. This is in, by the way, the summer of 1990. And because not only because of what I'd found on George Bush, but what I'd found on Lloyd Benson. And at that time, it certainly wasn't beyond the realm of possibility that the 92 election was going to be Bush versus Benson. And in fact, if you recall, when Clinton had all the trouble in earlier this year, in January and February, with Jennifer Flowers and the draft, he said that if he dropped out, he was going to throw his support behind Lloyd Benson. And now we have Benson being the leading candidate for the Secretary of Treasury. Okay, so I was pushing very hard, and Fulbright and Jaworski actually modified their standard contract to shorten the time between acceptance and publication.
You mean Simon & Schuster?
Simon & Schuster, I'm sorry. To shorten the time between acceptance and publication. And I eventually signed a contract with them, and when I took a leave of absence from the Post to write the book, I submitted the book on deadline, and I got back an editing letter a couple of months after that that told me that something wasn't exactly right here, because they wrote me a four-page letter that was just full of vague nonsense. I mean, it was not helpful at all. And when I submitted the manuscript on deadline, I again put in writing that the book had to be published before the 1992 election, in writing. So we began the editing process. And I tried to accommodate their suggestions, and I really couldn't. I made some alternative suggestions. They okayed it. I submitted a revised manuscript in February of this year, 92. And after they got the revised manuscript, but before they'd even read it, they really cut me off. They would not return my phone calls, my faxes, my letters, nothing. And so I was fairly desperate at that time. And I knew that they had what they call their fall list, the list of all the books they publish in the latter part of the year. And I knew that my book had to be on there to get out before the election. And so when they wouldn't return my phone calls or talk to me, I eventually made an appointment just to fly up to New York City and see them. And it was only at that time that they returned my phone call. And I told the editor, who was Alice Mayhew, who was Bob Woodward's editor, a very famous editor, you know, that the book needed to go before the election and we needed to get going. And she said she wasn't going to do it. They were not going to do the book before the election. And I said, why not? You know, all this stuff about Bush, the American public needs to know. And she said, quote, George Bush is going to win anyway. And, of course, she turned out to be wrong, but even so, that struck me as nonsense. I mean, what difference does that make about getting the information before the public, and what? How does she know that what's going to happen in 10 months or so?
Why do you think Simon & Schuster refused to publish the book before the election? It was ready to go, right?
Well, it was basically ready, and if they'd wanted to, they could have. Simon & Schuster is a very big company. I mean, I eventually got the book published before the election with a small company. I mean, they could have put two editors on it, and we could have done it. Mm-hmm. They didn't. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to speculate on their motives, but there's some interesting connections. In fact, I knew this going in. I knew about the connections between Simon & Schuster and George Bush and the Houston power brokers.
Oh, what is that?
Well, one of George Bush's best friends and longtime business associates, Hugh Ledke, chairman of the board of Pennzoil, is on the board of directors of Simon & Schuster's parent corporation, Paramount Communications. And Hugh Ledke is actually in my book in regard to a very strange bank in Houston that he was on the board of. Also, Paramount Communications used to be the successor company to Gulf and Western, the conglomerate that one of the founding fathers is John Duncan of Houston, whose brother Charles was Secretary of Energy under the Carter administration. And these people are in investments with people who connect to Walter Mischer and back to George Bush. And so I knew this going in. I just thought it would be poetic justice for Simon & Schuster to publish this book. But apparently they knew about it too, I guess.
Pete, you've been dealing with some pretty unsavory and dangerous characters here, the CIA and the Mafia. Have you had any threats in your life, or have you been fearful of it?
Well, not that I know of. I mean, I'm kind of slow. Maybe I got threatened and I didn't realize it, but nothing directly. I mean, these people usually leave reporters, and they don't you know, threaten reporters. I mean, they may try to keep the book from being published, or they might threaten you with, I've been threatened with lawsuits.
Oh.
I mean, they will do that, but not physically threatened. And, you know, the way they operate is to keep people like Simon Schuster from publishing the book, or keep anybody from publishing, or keeping it from being distributed. And so, you know, they work indirectly. If anything happened to me, that would just bring more publicity on this, and which is the last thing they want. I mean, the way they're reacting to the book is that they're really sort of kind of hunkering down and ignoring it, and figuring that any publicity will vanish eventually and disappear.
Have you been contacted by Larry King yet, or any of the
shows? The national media has shown no interest in this.
The one exception is the Village Voice that published a excellent article on your book and on your research by Jonathan Quitney, who's also an investigative reporter of some renown.
Right. That happened when Simon & Schuster told me they were not going to publish before the election. I contacted Quitney. I had been in touch with Jonathan Quitney because he'd written a number of books on the Mafia and the CIA. I wanted to sort of do a reality check and send the manuscript to Quitney and ask him whether he thought it should be published before the election, just to make sure that I wasn't hallucinating. Maybe Simon & Schuster was right. And so I sent the manuscript to Quitney, and he read it and agreed with me that it should be published before the election. And he was helping me, you know, get the information out, and actually had gone to a number of different publications to try to do, you know, a serialization of the book, and eventually the Village Voice did it, but just barely before the election. And even though the book was printed 4 weeks before the election, it really didn't get out. I mean, it should have been out in the summer. You know, I really apologize. I did everything that I knew how. And if you told somebody in, say, May of this year that you could get a book published in 5 months, they would have laughed at you. So it was not possible. Well, we did it, but just barely.
Pete, let's talk a little bit about the sort of final response of your work by the establishment, by journalists, Congress, and then possibly the public, and how you reacted to the sort of non-response of the sort of journalist establishment and then the Congress. You yourself were a reporter for the Houston Post. You published these articles about the CIA and the SNL, so were explosive investigative reporting, and they just weren't picked up by the national media. What did this lead you to conclude towards the press in the United States? Well, did this change your attitude anyway?
Well, I mean, some of the press picked up the stories, but the television networks and the big three, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, never did anything. And I personally think the reason they didn't was because it wasn't their story. Okay, and they like to do their own investigative work, and they were very far behind. It would have been impossible for them to do the work it would take to do these stories in a manner that would, you know, that would be a good job. And these institutions had not even done the SNL stories right. I mean, they had ignored, done a little bit, but it was all they were just recycling the work that had basically been done by the Dallas Morning News and Byron Harris and WFAA in Dallas, which was to write about all the Wheeler Dealer, Don Dixon, Ed McBurney types. And that began to be sort of the pattern of investigative reporting. If you did investigative reporting on SNLs, you wrote about all the wild and crazy guys down in Texas that were looting these SNLs, and you didn't do what you should have done, which was follow the money. I mean, that's the big advice, you know, Deep Throat gave Bob Woodward in Watergate. Follow the money. That's where the story is. That's where the story is in the SNLs, but the reporters did not do that. It was right about the front man and the wild and crazy guys. So these institutions did not do a very good job on the SNLs. So they didn't have the foundation to do either the Mafia or the CIA involvement. So, you know, if you don't do something, they're the kind of institutions and people that just ignore it. You know, it's not our story, it's not worth doing, we're just going to ignore it. You know, if we didn't do it, it must not be worth anything. So that's exactly what happens.
Now, what about Congress? When you first made these revelations that the CIA was involved in robbing the CIA of the savings and loan and using the money to help support the Contras and other illegal off-the-book operations, Congress made some noise that they were going to do some investigation. What came out of this?
Well, actually, the House Permanent Subcommittee on Intelligence, which has oversight of the CIA, did a preliminary investigation by their staff and eventually came up and said there's nothing to this. But it's there are several interesting points to note. Number one, they never did what they should have done, which was track any of the money. They relied on the CIA for all their information, and even the CIA admitted that of the 20 institutions we named, that they had dealt with four of them, and that they had dealt with five of the individuals we had named, but they had done nothing wrong. And the thing is that the staff director of the House Intelligence Committee, who was overseeing the investigation, a guy named Dan Childs, had come from he was the chief financial officer of the CIA and had been brought over to the intelligence subcommittee right before my stories came out. And the CIA, of course, was aware. I mean, I had been talking to them for months, so they knew that my stories were going to break soon. Dan Childs also had been brought in 10 years earlier in the Senate Intelligence Committee that had been doing the church investigation that was exposing all the illegal domestic activities of the CIA. Childs had been brought in for damage control. It certainly looked like he was being brought in for damage control. And in fact, after they released their report saying there was nothing to this, Childs went back to the CIA. Now he's the executive assistant to the CIA director.
This is shameless. It's like this guy Polgar, who was put in charge of investigating Iran-Contra, who was another lifetime CIA operative, station chief of about six different places, as you point out in your book. So basically, Congress didn't do anything.
No.
They covered it up. The press really didn't do anything. And now the Clinton administration faces as much as a $500 billion price tag for the CIA scandal. So what can the government finally do about this?
Congress and the Justice Department can track the money. That's all they have to do. And if there was fraud involved, they can get it back. And they haven't done this. I mean, everybody's acting like it's a foregone conclusion that we've lost $500 billion. You know, okay, taxpayers, take the hit and go on. It's not true. The Justice Department is very capable of tracking this money. They can track drug money that starts out as cash in the United States, goes offshore, and comes back. Surely they can track S&L money that's always a paper or wire transfer. It's easy to track if you got subpoena power. Congress could do it, but they're not doing it. And I don't know whether Clinton is going to make the Justice Department do this or not. You know, it's going to be interesting to see who the new Attorney General is going to be and whether they're going to go out. I mean, I don't see any indication on Clinton's part that he has any interest in kicking this sleeping dog. And I think he just wants to let it lie and not mess with it, because his party is just as involved as the Republicans. And so I don't see, there's going to have to be mass revolt by the American people, and the American people don't have the information.
So what is the responsibility of the press and the citizens to do something about this S&L scandal?
Well, I mean, the press has got to do the reporting and the citizens have to do the complaining.
We turn now to some news stories from the Alternative
Press. And
that's
where Alternative Views ends.
World Press Review has some
fraud,
the stories, some opinions of various newspapers
the
around the world.
Alternative Views,
most of the
as
quotes
a reminder
are,
of how much quality
not all
alternative
that significant.
Material
but there are a couple
was,
of them that I thought you might be interested
back in. The 1990s,
one from Munich Independent newspaper says it's difficult to discern a program or policy in the new president's persona. He succeeded in pleasing everyone and antagonizing no one. And it was a very perfect marketing strategy. So their conclusion was that Clinton was not elected. Bush was summarily fired. And in Tehran, they said that our experience with the USA during the past half century has left us with no illusions about either Republicans or Democrats. A desire for hegemony is so deep-rooted in the psyche of the American political establishment that the new president, even though he's a Democrat, has no choice but to tread the path of norm in traditional USA foreign policy.
One of Bill Clinton's chief campaign pledges was to limit the influence of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. Well, the New York Times News Service reports that his transition team has extensive industry and ties to foreign countries. For instance, Vernon Jordan, the transition chairman, earns at least $442,000 a year in fees from sitting on the boards of 11 corporate giants, including Union Carbide, American Express, Xerox, and the debt-laden RJR Nabisco. Jordan also holds almost $1 million worth of stock in these companies. And his law firm, Aiken Gump, Hauer & Feld, represents at least 7 of these corporations as well, and as a senior partner, he shares in the law firm's profits. The transition director, working right under Jordan, Warren Christopher, is the senior partner in one of the nation's largest law firms, O'Melveny & Myers, whose clients include Mitsui, Sumitomo Trust and Banking, Japan Airlines, and Hyundai. And during the campaign, Clinton made a point of criticizing lobbyists who work for foreign interests, but the Japanese interests, at least, are well represented in his transition team. As well, Christopher earned at least $73,000 last year from sitting on the boards of Lockheed Corporation and Southern California Edison, and his firm also represents both corporations. So you can imagine what sort of feelings this person is going to have about regulating utilities and also military cutbacks. Also, Mickey Cantor, another board member on the transition team, is a member of Manette Phelps, Phillips and Cantor, which has done work for the governments of Cyprus and Jamaica, and for a wide array of for-profit healthcare corporations, real estate, and transportation firms. He also does lobbying for Japan's NEC Corporation, the cable television industry, and a number of big oil companies. He also, on the side, conducted a policy briefing for a number of his clients and potential clients, including General Electric. Samuel Berger, another member, the transition team's foreign policy director, also has for years presided over an international trade firm, the international trade practice at Hogan & Hartson, a law firm whose clients have included Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Bahamas, Ontario, Japan again, and the trading arm of China, as well as the Toshiba Corporation of Japan. And when Toshiba got in trouble with the U.S. government for exporting sensitive technology to the former Soviet Union, Berger was there in Washington helping to defend Toshiba's interests. As Ralph Nader put it, Cesar Chavez isn't getting any calls, and there have been widespread complaints from the coalition that elected Clinton, which includes many civil rights leaders, people working for migrant farmers, people working for other minority rights, that people from these institutions just haven't been called upon. Clinton's gone for the traditional lobbyists and lawyers who have always been sitting inside the Beltway dictating what's done to the congressmen.
I think it's very significant that, what was that, from the New York Times, Washington Post?
New York Times News Service.
Right. See, they're not going to point out other connections and interconnections with Clinton and the staff that he's putting together. For instance, I look at the sociology of leadership. What organizations do these people come from? And who are the other people that they associate with? Well, Bill Clinton was a member of the Bilderberger, that secret organization, as well as the Council on Foreign Relations. Vernon Jordan is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. Warren Christopher is a member of all three of those elite organizations. Henry Cisneros is a member of the CFR. And, of course, Lloyd Benson, the they say you're going to be our new Secretary of Treasury, attended Bilderberg meetings recently as well. So the people that Clinton has in his transition team are people from this very small group of elite organizations. And very few people are members of these organizations. Council on Foreign Relations only has about 1,500 to 1,700. But the number of people in government from these organizations is huge compared to their size. So we're seeing the same type of thing that we did before in the in the Bush and Reagan years. They came from these organizations.
Well, the Carter people too.
And the Carter. So it's just basically Carter. Carter revisited, except Clinton is more conservative than Carter, and Clinton came from the Democratic Leadership Council, which was a rebellion against the liberal hegemony of the Democrats. And I saw a statistic where it said that the Congress people, who also support the Democratic Leadership Council, they voted with the Reagan-Bush years. They voted for Reagan and Bush 80% to 90% of the time. So it's questionable as how much change Bill Clinton wants or how much he can achieve, even if he wants it.
So this, I think, is a major indication that at least when it comes to economics, it's going to be business as usual with the Clinton administration. My guess is that Clinton's going to continue the conservative policies of the previous decade in the area of economics and foreign policy, and he'll have a much more liberal agenda on social issues.
World Press Review has a couple of articles about the mafia, which are really quite disturbing. It says that the mafia, like the rest of the economy in the 80s, has gone global and has forged alliances wherever it's needed to, killed wherever it's needed to, and is sponsoring indigenous crime syndicates under its control in a lot of countries where they weren't operating before, particularly, say, in Eastern Europe. It has managed to come to grips and work out relationships with the Turkish heroin bosses, the Colombia drug cartels. So internationally, it's stronger than it ever has been. And even, you know, you hear references here and there to the Russian mafia taking over so much of what is happening in the chaos in Russia right now. Well, that mafia is actually connected with the Italian-Sicilian mafia. Things have changed a bit, though, in that the mafia still kills in Italy. They've seen that. However, they've kind of gone along with the Colombian style of killing now. They use, instead of just very clean assassinations with their rifles or so, or submachine guns, they're doing it now with car bombs, which actually kill a lot of civilians as well. As an indication of the strength and internationalization of the mafia, on St. Valentine's Day, appropriately enough, in 1989, there was a meeting in Nice of members of the international consortium of illegals. The Sicilian mafia, which is the octopus, the giant mafia, they also, with representatives of the Colombian and Venezuelan cartels, well, they all got together so that they could divide up the world's spoils, so that they wouldn't have competition with each other, they wouldn't be trampling on each other, or they wouldn't have to be killing each other. Cartelization of crime around the world. And what's happening in Italy? There have been some well-publicized assassinations recently, and the people have had a lot of outcry against the mafia. But this has been going on for some time. There will be assassinations, people come up in arms, there will be investigations, and the government say, well, we're going to do something about it, but then nothing ever gets done. It's business as usual. And that is because, according to the World Press Review articles, the establishment in Italy is right in bed, has a very cozy working relationship with the mafia, and so they're not doing anything about it. So they're becoming stronger and stronger all around the world. It's ironic. This parallel development with international capital, and the mafia keeps lockstep right along with it.
Well, according to the New York Times, a rising cost of modernity is depression. If the 20th century ushered in the age of anxiety, its exit, according to the Times, is witnessing the dawn of the age of melancholy. The first international study of major depression reveals a steady rise in the disorder worldwide. The nations as diverse as the United States, Taiwan, Lebanon, and New Zealand, in these countries, in each generation, the possibility of getting serious depression, not just sadness, but a paralyzing listlessness, dejection, self-depreciation, an overwhelming sense of hopelessness, that these days it's three times likelier that you're going to get this depression, it's going to set in, than your grandparents. There's been a lot of speculation of why melancholy is on the rise. Some speculate that loss in a belief of God takes away a buffer against life's setbacks. Others say the distress created in women by the spread of unattainable ideals of female beauty is a cause, whereas others say that it's physiological, that it has to do more with exposure to toxic substances. And there's been a big debate over why younger Americans also in recent years have had a much, much higher case of melancholy than the former generation. Recent studies in journals in the United States indicate that there's a much, much higher proportion of people that are getting melancholy these days, and it's become a modern epidemic.
I have a couple of short articles here on Poland, one from the World Press Review of, let's see, December 1992, and the other from Dollars and Cents, also December 1992. The World Press Review says that the Polish government foresees five more years of recession before things start becoming a little bit better for the people in Poland. And it seems that even that 5 years taking it that long was a compromise between the reformists and the people who want to go a little bit slower and ease the pain. But according to Dollars and Cents, it's ironic that the people who are supposedly foisting this on the people, all this pain, are the people who actually used to come from the labor ranks. Remember, Lech Walesa was the leader of the labor union Solidarity. Now, in the summer of 92, group of unions that had spearheaded Solidarity are now going out on wildcat strikes against Solidarity and the Walesa leadership. But there's a very interesting quote by the prime minister who, when the workers started striking, she sent out dismissal notices to them. They just kick them out, and so the leaders of the strike immediately scaled back their wage demands. Well, the woman who was the prime minister came from a satellite party of the communists originally back in 1984, and she was expelled from the party for voting against taking away Solidarity's legal status. But she's changed her mind now. Here's what she says about the workers. For 40 years, the workers were treated as the most important class on which the whole system of the state stood. And it's very bitter for them to understand that the new conditions require them to step down to a very low status.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. That's if you'd like to download them individually. If you'd like to download them 100 at a time, if you have a fat internet connection, you can try that from unwelcomeguests.net/downloads. Just to help us understand what it means to steal $500 billion. If the American population was, say, 250 million, that's $2,000 from every man, woman, and child. So if we think about it in real terms, and people are working for, say, $10 an hour, then that is a theft of 200 hours from every man, woman, and child. For what it's worth, I think as long as people continue to use money these sort of frauds will continue to be perpetrated. For modern day frauds, look no further than quantitative easing, bailouts, TARPs, whatever you name it, and that's just the ones of which we have been made aware. I am looking forward to a day when money is no longer seen as a requirement and people are free, unhindered by financial concerns, to express their care for themselves, for one another, and for all life on the planet which we share together. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa's first community radio station. Denied a license under the old apartheid regime, Bush Radio went on the air illegally in 1993. Two broadcasters were arrested and the equipment confiscated. After the historic election in 1994, the first broadcast licenses issued by the Mandela government were specifically for community broadcasters. In June of 1995, Bush Radio began licensed broadcasts. In celebration of World Radio Day and Black History Month 2016, this is a rebroadcast of an interview with Brenda Leonard. She's one of the founders of Bush Radio. I asked Brenda for a 2016 update, and she wrote, "Currently, South Africa has over 250 community radio stations, and they're reaching over 9.2 million listeners each day, which means over 170 stations have been added since 2009. Bush Radio is still a model for community radio and continues to train much of the staff at the new radio stations. They are always looking for innovative ways of engaging their listeners and marginalized groups. Controversial issues are discussed in town halls, and the debate is aired live on the air with audience participation, both inside the town hall and through SMS, Facebook, and phone calls." Thanks to Brenda Leonard for this update. And here now is the program that I produced in 2009. When you visit Bush Radio in Cape Town any Saturday morning, you find children as young as 6 years doing their own programming. Weekdays, the news department presents local news on the air and as blog, including photos and video. Noam Chomsky came to Bush Radio to be interviewed and stayed for 5 more hours because he enjoyed the, quote, vitality, seriousness, and professionalism of staff and volunteers. Broadcasters come from around the world to spend up to 3 months at Bush Radio to get inspired by a new kind of community radio that brought black people on the air for the first time in South African history. In the summer of 2009, Brenda Leonard, the Bush Radio administrator, went on a U.S. tour of public radio stations. I met her in San Francisco and asked her to tell me about the day-to-day operations of Bush Radio.
We broadcast 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. What we've done is we have people during the day that's like interns, so they get a little bit of an allowance. And then from 4 o'clock we run completely with volunteers, so the volunteers do the programming. Saturdays and Sundays, volunteers completely doing the programming. And what we've done with our programming is we actually try to align the different days into themes. So you have Mondays, you have health, and we try all the programs to have some health within the program. Tuesdays you have human rights, and you deal with any issue of human rights. It can be the whole question of like marriages, mixed marriages, anything like that. Then on Wednesdays we deal with gender, and gender deals with, like, besides the gender-based violence, looking at power in terms of gender, looking at the whole question of HIV and AIDS and gender and so on. Thursdays we deal with labor issues. We talk about the economy and how it affects people. We talk about rights, the rights of workers. We've talked so many, like, if new legislation comes in or if it's being introduced and people can still make an impact into the legislation, we'll talk about the legislation and its impact, get people to analyze the impact and so on. So that, and then Fridays we deal with environment and arts and culture. Then we also have on our morning show at about 10 past 9 every day till 9:30, we have a job shop, what we call job shop. So people get faxes and emails, and if not, they use the newspaper and then tell people of jobs that's available and give them the numbers, or they can call the station and get the numbers. And in that sense, offer service to people who's unemployed, who can't necessarily afford a newspaper. Overall programming, we have about 60% talk and 40% music. And we have a lot of women in the station. Our news, when I look at the news, we have 4 females and 2 males. If we look at our programming during the day, we have mostly females, probably about 60-70% is females. Mm-hmm. In the night, it's a bit different because of safety. Mm-hmm. So you find that the nights is normally dominated by males. So we ensure at least where we can, during the day, we have mostly females in the station.
Do you still have childcare?
Yes, we do. You know about that. Yes, we do. We have childcare upstairs. And it helps for people who come for training who have small kids or people who just come for an interview. And then obviously it's open to the community as well.
Oh, so how many children do you have on a given day?
We have 6 to sometimes up to 10, depending. Yeah, and it's open normally quite early in the morning from about 6:30. And it's open till 5 in the afternoon.
Yes. And who's taking care of them, volunteers or paid staff?
No, paid staff. We actually have 2 paid staff that we pay out of our salaries. Yeah, and we do, like some of the people who come on a regular basis, we do charge them a little amount. So that goes towards the salaries, and then Bush Radio tops up the rest.
Are there examples where you sit in an editorial meeting and you say, this is really what we should do?
We do. Not necessarily it comes from us. It might come from one of the presenters where they picked up something, they interviewed someone. They said, you know, this is happening now. We should really look at it. Just before I came to the U.S., one of the news people came to me and they had something about the special rights areas that's introduced by the city of Cape Town, where they want people in certain areas to pay a little bit extra, and then they get specialized services, like more quality services. Mm-hmm. And we had a big problem with that, and I'm hoping that while I'm here, they're taking the issue further and actually start mobilizing people around that, because I think something like that will just divide the city into rich and poor, and we'll have major problems down the line. Another example, the city of Cape Town wanted to introduce a graffiti bylaw, where people weren't allowed to have graffiti on the walls. And they wanted to criminalize people who do actually do graffiti. And we felt that graffiti is an art form. It's a form of expression. And it should not be criminalized. So what we've done is we actually ran a very public campaign around it. And we got graffiti artists to come and spray paint our hall, our garage door, on the side of the building. And we had all the media there. And then while they were in the middle of doing that, this one guy that's pushing it in the city of Cape Town, he heard, saw it on the news, and he came to our building while they're busy doing it, and he was there basically asking us why we're challenging him and so on. But the cameras were there, and all of it were recorded. So I think that boosted the whole campaign about having it not criminalized a lot. After that, they've actually dropped it. They didn't do it, so they introduced it now again as something they want to reconsider. There's constantly things like that. I must be honest, we don't always know of everything happening, but the stuff we know and we disagree with, we will actually take up. We've also done the whole thing on Bush against war, the whole thing about the war in Iraq by George Bush when he invaded Iraq. South Africans were taking a strong stand against war, not only in Iraq, but in any part of the world. And we had massive rallies and marches in our streets. And Bush Radio, as a radio station with a name similar to George Bush, we decided to bring out a T-shirt called Bush Against War. It became one of our most popular T-shirts that was distributed right around the world. So I think things like that we do as a station. The reason sometimes people say, but you're a radio station, you should be balanced in your reporting and you shouldn't take a stand, and we disagree. We think as community media, community radio, we can take a stand because we're activists and we want a particular social change in our community. And for us to do that, we need to take a stand on issues.
So do you have formal training for young people to learn radio?
Yes, we do. We do a lot of training. We do training in the whole of the Southern Africa region. We do training in South Africa. We do training in the province. We do our own volunteers training. And we do training for International Colleges Group as a correspondence college. So they do a theoretical course in broadcasting and people come to the practical at Bush Radio. So there's always something happening to do with training at Bush Radio. We also get interns from across the world. We get interns from inside South Africa, journalism students that need to do an internship. So there's like constantly people moving. I always tell people, if you visit us today and you come back in a month's time, you're probably going to see new faces and some faces is not going to be here. So that they understand how fluid the movement of people are at Bush Radio. For young people specifically, we have a program called CREW, Children's Radio Education Workshop. And what we do, we train children between the ages of 6 to 18 to research, present, produce, and engineer their own radio programs. So on a Saturday, really, the radio station is taken over by young people that does everything. We try not to intervene in the program. We sometimes have to, especially if they put out wrong information. And I think that's probably the only time we would interfere. But otherwise, they can talk about what is important to them. We have one criteria. We tell them the music they play must be at least 50% South African music. Because that's a bit of a problem. They all go to the American top 20s. And then we have to tell them, what about South African? We're a community station. We must play South African music. So in that sense, educate them about music. So that's the one training we do for young people. Then we also do, for a little bit older than 18-year-olds, we every year take 6 journalism students from the local university. And they come and they spend a year doing an internship. Now what we do with them is we train them firstly for 2 months. And the training prepares them to run the newsroom. And our newsroom is not only a radio newsroom. We also do blogging. So they need to understand how to blog. They need to know how to take photos, because we put photos on our blog. And they need to know how to do short video clips, because we put video on our blog. So all of that, besides the new training of writing a bulletin, getting your voice reports, getting your clips for your news, getting that, doing a voice report if you're outside at the event and what it entails. Besides that, and reading, they must also understand the multimedia component. So in that sense, when they leave, they have experience in all of those things. And we found now in the past year that our journalism graduates are actually sought after by big media companies, because most of the media companies are moving to multimedia journalism and they don't want to train people. So here you have a pool of young people that are trained in multimedia and they find work very, very easily. So that's another thing we do in terms of training. Then most of our presenters on ER, volunteer presenters, are young people. So we train them also. And what we also do is that we get a lot of applications from people, and we really can't take everyone. But what we tell people is, listen, apply. What we can do is we take you to the through the training. And if we don't take you, at least we can give you a letter saying that you've gone through this training and you can go to one of the other community stations, because then they don't need to train you. So in that sense, we help them if they want to make it in radio, want radio as the field of choice.
You are listening to an interview with Brenda Leonard. She has been the administrator of Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, since the licensing of the station in 1995. I asked her how Bush Radio connects with the community.
We have, firstly, what is called the open forum. A forum we have once a month. Anyone in the community can actually come and participate in this forum. So what we do in this forum is we discuss, we basically give a report back to the community to say, okay, this is what we're doing, what we've done the past month, these are our challenges and so on. And then people can also ask us questions about anything. So sometimes people say, I don't like this presenter because of whatever reason. And we always tell them, listen, we can't take all your suggestions and implement it. So some of it we'll take and some of it, but give us the suggestion. Sometimes people make very good suggestions. Like, I know we have a HIV and AIDS program that's on, like, in the midday. And people would suggest that we actually rebroadcast the program sometime over the weekend, because they don't always get time to listen to it. And I think those kind of suggestions we do look into and see how we can change it. Then we have, like we do our outside broadcast, we do community events that where we go to community events, and then people always interact. In fact, normally if we say on air that we're going to be at this event, then it brings people to the event because we want to come and greet their favorite presenters and so on. That I think the biggest part of community participation for us is that we have volunteers, 150 volunteers. It comes from different parts of communities. So they become a source of information for that community. So they will phone us if anything happens in the communities, or people will tell them and they will then call us and we'll do the follow-ups and so on. So if you listen to news, the programming, the content, it's very local. Mm-hmm. It deals with issues that affects the community. And it shows that we're very, like, entrenched within the community.
I always wonder how much a radio station could actually really produce a change, like, for instance, in matters of healthy food or housing or education. Do you have some examples of how a station can engage itself mm-hmm. over a longer period of time and actually something is different at the end?
Mm-hmm. I think the one example I can use is that we've... not last year, in 2007, the teachers in South Africa went on a strike about wages, and it was an extremely long strike. It was something like nearly 3 months they went on the strike. So obviously 3 months out of the education, daily teaching takes a lot of time out of the syllabus, implementing the syllabus. And we had a discussion with them and the education department, and we said, listen, this is happening. Please, how can we help? And they said, okay, maybe what we must do revision programs on air. So what we did is we worked out the whole program, and we would have revisions for each subject for matriculants. And that ran over 2 months of revisions. So you had huge audiences, matriculants tuning in to listen to the revisions, like for their subjects in preparing, phoning in or emailing or SMSing, texting a message, asking questions to the subject educators that were there. And I think that for us, we reached over 800,000 matriculants, yeah. And we were lucky in the sense that our matric rate didn't go down, even though you would expect it to go down after 3 months' strike. It actually went up. So the education department attributed that a lot to the help of community radio stations. Because what we've done is we've mobilized all the stations and we put the same program on all the stations. And I think that was very important. That was one where you could tangibly see at the end of the day the change.
How many hours, what subjects, how was it done?
It was 2 hours a day, every day, and it was one subject a day. So say for instance you do maths standard grade, for instance, then we did maths standard grade. Mathematics higher grade, accountancy, your geography, any subject, your language subjects, English of Afrikaans, Xhosa, all your language subjects. So each of those subjects had a day. And sometimes you write more than one paper. So you had paper one, paper two, paper three, that kind of thing. The education department also did with that is they actually printed a lot of past matriculant exam papers, and they distributed it to the community station so the schools could collect those papers as well from the radio station, and the schools then distributed it at the schools, and we handed out all of it. We had boxes and boxes and boxes, and we handed out all of those exam papers to us.
So who were your programmers for, let's say, history? Who came into the station to do the lecture?
It was all teachers. What we've done is we had three people in the studio. We had one person from the education department, one person from a curriculum point of view, the people that can overly tell you, the curriculum people, they're the ones that set the test. And then the last person was actually a teacher. And the teachers came from local schools, like surrounding the station.
That is Brenda Leonard, administrator of Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa. My last question for her was about the beginning of the station and how Bush Radio got its name.
Bush Radio was formed in the late 80s at the university called UWC, University of the Western Cape. And they were a college that was set up for black people. And you had the college in the middle, surrounded by dense bushes. The name, when people refer to the college, is Bush. And that's why when we started having the first talks, and this took place at Bush, and people looked at the name, they said, oh, let's call it Bush Radio. And since then, our name have actually stuck. And that's still our name up till today, even though sometimes people say, maybe we should change the name to something more funky and so on. But we like our name. We then applied for license in the early 90s to the government. It was still apartheid government. They refused. They did not give us a license. So in 1993, we ran a very public campaign saying that we're going to broadcast illegally. And it wasn't underground or anything like that. We had a small studio set up in the office. We set up the transmitter. Not at Bush, at one of the trade union buildings, actually, with an antenna on their roof. And we broadcast it on a Sunday in April, 25th of April. We broadcast it for 4 hours. The police and the post office workers, because at that stage, broadcasting fell under the post office. with telecommunications. So there were police, and the post office came to our premises the Monday, and they wanted to confiscate the transmitter. We had them look for it. We didn't tell them where it was. They found it at the trade union building. They confiscated it. They arrested two people. They were charged with being in possession of broadcasting equipment, using the broadcasting equipment, and defeating the aims of the law, something like that. And the case went on for about a year. But I think from 1993, there were a number of changes in the country. You had, for instance, that by that time, most of the ANC people had returned back into South Africa. We had these negotiations taking place, the Kudesa talks taking place on a daily basis. And you also had Radio Pretoria and Radio Kopis, which were right-wing white stations, actually broadcasting illegally as well. The government left them. They didn't actually take them off air. And what we've done when we went to court is to use this as a clear indication that the attack taking Bush off air was racist in its nature and that it didn't fit in the current political situation. So based on that, it was kicked out of court. We then had a choice of either going and broadcasting again illegally. We did actually. They gave the transmitter back. And we told them, no, you've had our transmitter for a year. We're going to test it. And we're going to put it on air. So it was the same time that Chris Hani actually passed away. And we then put it on and we did a dedicated program to Chris Hani. So from that time, we then felt, okay, we've made our point. Let's see where the processes, the political processes is going to. And then we'll decide whether we're going to broadcast illegally again or what. Obviously, we had the historic elections in 1994. And then Mandela was the president. They've set up then a committee to, it's an independent structure called the Independent Broadcasting Authority, IBA. And their role was to regulate broadcasting in South Africa. And the first thing they did was to call for license applications from community radios. And we applied and we got the license to broadcast in 1995. We could go on air on the 1st of August, but we then decided we're not going to go on the 1st of August, we'll go on the 9th of August, because the 9th of August in our country, for the first time, was recognized as National Women's Day. And we felt that because of the contribution that women has played in getting Bush Radio to where it was, we need to recognize that, and we'll start our first broadcast, legal broadcast, on the 9th of August. And that's what we've done.
You heard an interview with Brenda Leonard, co-founder and now manager of Bush Radio, in Cape Town, South Africa. I spoke to her in May of 2009. Bush Radio played a huge role in defining the laws and practice of community radio in South Africa. Almost every one of the over 250 stations in South Africa today employs somebody trained at Bush Radio. It's now easy for you to get a first-hand impression of Bush Radio. Visit their website at bushradio.co.za or their Facebook pages at Bush Radio South Africa. You heard the rebroadcast of an interview about Bush Radio South Africa in honor of World Radio Day 2016 and Black History Month. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Geloden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team in Toronto. I'm your host, Fraser McPherson. In this episode,
what British Columbia failed to do was to consult and accommodate First Nations.
Because of my experiences, I demand the status on landing for all migrant workers.
Any media producer can sign up and upload content to the Community Radio Exchange, and anyone can listen to uploaded pieces.
But first, here are the headlines. Teck Metals Limited is charged with violations of the Fisheries Act and the Environmental Management Act, and plans to plead guilty on Monday, February 1st, for releasing toxic waste into the environment in 2013 and 2014. Catherine Fisher from CJLY brings us this headline.
Teck Metals Limited, which operates the world's largest lead-zinc smelter, plans to plead guilty on Monday, February 1st, to 15 charges of causing pollution stemming from incidents in Trail, B.C. Trail is a community of about 7,000 people located in interior BC on Sinike's traditional territory. Teck, which is the region's largest employer, is being charged with violations of the Fisheries Act and the Environmental Management Act, specifically for discharging copper, zinc, and other caustic waste from a fertilizer plant and a metallurgical plant into the environment in 2013 and 2014. Teck's acknowledged and been fined for numerous toxic spills over the last few years, but the destructive practices arising from the Trail smelter, originally called Cominco, actually date back much further to 1896. More recently, in 2008, Teck accidentally dumped 1,000 kilograms of lead solution into the Columbia River. They were later fined $115,000 for what the trial judge called significant negligence. In 2011, the company was fined $325,000 for two other chemical spills in Trail, including one where mercury was released, also into the Columbia River. In 2013, Teck paid $210,000, this time for discharging sodium hydroxide into the river. Teck owns or has an interest in 13 mines, one large metallurgical complex, a wind power facility, and several major development projects in Canada, the United States, Chile, and Peru.
The commemorative march for missing and murdered Indigenous women is coming up in Montreal. Audrey O'Braham brings us this headline from the Missing Justice Committee.
Montreal-based organization Missing Justice continues to honor the memory of the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada and raise awareness about this issue. The 7th annual March for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women will occur on Sunday, February 14th at 3 p.m. It will begin at Saint-Laurent Metro in Montreal. For Groundwire News, I am Audrey O'Braham.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
We can't change the past, only protect the future. Keep defending land,
Don't let settlers fool ya. Treaties never died. They still have memories. Settlers are alive. We still have enemies and allies too. All races befriended me because we are treaty people, fundamentally and uphold peace. We still have memories of sacred traditions and all their complexity for self-defense. We still have weaponry. Don't mess with me, physically or mentally. While I heal from my ancestors' enemy to win black and native freedom eventually. I don't know more, my ancestors sending me to go and fight for those who descend from me. I don't know more applies to my people too. Africans, Caribbeans need a boost. I don't know more. 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 I don't know more.
You just heard Idle No More by Wasson featuring Science and James Blood from Wasson's latest album, Comrade Music. Now it's time for our feature stories. The Supreme Court of British Columbia has ruled against the assessment for Enbridge's Northern Gateway pipeline. The Supreme Court found that the project's assessment did not address concerns of the province, nor obtain consent from Gitgat First Nations. CKUT brings us this interview with Art Starrett, who discusses the province's puzzling decision to leave the assessment in the hands of the National Energy Board.
Yeah, my name is Art Starrett. I've been active in land use planning, marine use planning, and economic development on the coast of British Columbia for about the last 15 years. In particular, an area known as the Great Bear Rainforest is an area that I've spent many, many years championing on behalf of all coastal First Nations. And more recently, I was engaged in a court case, which is intended to address the issue of the Northern Gateway pipeline and tankers on the coast, north coast of British Columbia. And the reason for that was to make sure that we protect what we have in the area, the amazing land use plans and marine use plans and economic development initiatives that we've created in the area.
Not a couple of days ago, we heard the final ruling. The province was found to be in breach of the Crown because normally the assessment for the program is supposed to be done by the province, in which case they would have to get consent and work alongside your communities there, First Nations communities. And in this case, they had not done that. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, what British Columbia failed to do was to consult and accommodate First Nations with regard to the decision around Northern Gateway. And what they did do is they entered into what's called an equivalency agreement, right, whereby they say that the environmental assessment that's done by the National Energy Board is equivalent to one that they would do. So in saying that, they're saying if you do that, then we will recognize your decision because we think it's equivalent to what we do. We took exception to that as the Gitgat Nation because British Columbia and Canada do not have an equivalent agreement. In right. fact, BC has more stringent environmental conditions. In fact, they laid out five conditions for Northern Gateway, informed the National Energy Board that they shouldn't approve the project, but just left it at that. But in fact, when they were informing the National Energy Board that they didn't approve the project, that they felt that Northern Gateway or Enbridge had not met their conditions, they actually had the opportunity to remove themselves from the equivalency agreement and decide whether or not to sign off on an environmental certificate or assessment of British Columbians' own making. And they didn't do that. So on one side, they were speaking against it, saying don't approve. On the other side, they themselves could have rejected the presentation that was made by Northern Gateway. And that just didn't sit right with the get-go.
Right. So far, people are saying the project is all but dead in official terms. They're saying that they do have the federal go-ahead, quote-unquote. In your opinion, do you think that this is the end for this particular project, or do you think they have any sort of recourse? Because I know that the current ruling, they are reviewing it, the Supreme Court is reviewing it. Do you think that this could come back in the future, and in what sort of power?
Well, the Supreme Court won't be reviewing it. This is a Supreme Court of British Columbia decision. I'm sure British Columbia is reviewing it.
Right.
They have the option of appealing it or not. We think we've done them a big favor. We think that we have put a court case out there that describes very clearly what British Columbia's power is. And we think that's a good thing.
Right, yes.
Particularly in light of the fact that British Columbia has opposed Northern Gateway. And more recently, they've opposed Kinder Morgan. This gives them the opportunity to act on their opposition and to impose the very stringent environmental conditions that British Columbia has. British Columbia also has much greater oversight once projects are approved to make sure that things are done properly and protected into the future. So I wouldn't expect that British Columbia would oppose something that gives them greater power.
Right.
However, you never know. You never know if they want to continue to duck their responsibility. Then I guess we'll end up going to a higher court. There is one mistake that is being made in this whole exercise, and that's, for example, Enbridge Northern Gateway is saying, "Well, this court case doesn't matter. The National Energy Board has the power here." Well, that's not true. And it's not true because the Supreme Court of British Columbia said it's not true. Now, we've been saying this now since 2013. This didn't just start yesterday. The Coastal First Nations and the Gitgat Nation in particular said to British Columbia back then, look, you need to take back your power. You can't just delegate it without discussing that with us. So we have now brought a lot of clarity to this issue, and I think empowered British Columbia with regard to these processes, and empowered them in terms of their ability to negotiate with industry.
To mark the 50th anniversary of the Migrant Farm Workers Program, Justicia for Migrant Workers will be organizing actions across Canada to highlight the resistance that migrant farm workers have undertaken to counter the exploitation they face as a result of inhumane immigration policies. They launched their Harvesting Freedom campaign last week in Ottawa.
On Monday, January 25th, the advocacy group Justicia for Migrant Workers launched their historic Harvesting Freedom campaign. The campaign calls on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to grant migrant farm workers immigration status upon arrival rather than the current model that leaves workers vulnerable to abuse. Harvesting Freedom is a year-long campaign that will feature a pilgrimage to Ottawa set to arrive on October 2nd, 2016. At the press conference, migrants spoke about the difficulties they encountered with the various temporary labor programs in Canada that allowed for exploited and easy access to needed labor without providing a pathway to citizenship. We hear of the experiences from two migrant workers, Gina and Alberto, and their calls for the granting of permanent status for migrant workers.
Good morning, I'm Gina from the Philippines. I came to Canada under the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. I worked in vegetable packing, hotel, and food industry. Low-wage workers like myself coming to Canada in the Temporary Foreign Worker Program the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program, the Caregiver Program, are tied to employers, single employer, closed, which means closed work permit. This means that we are subject to abuse, exploitation, and separation from our families. I lost my first job because I tried to speak up. I tried to fight for my rights and recruitment fees. I helped other co-workers to speak up, and they were threatened of deportation. I helped another worker to get back the money paid for recruitment fees, and I ended up losing another job. I witnessed many migrant workers who are abused, exploited, and can't speak up because of their fear of being deported and losing their job. Because of my experiences, I demand the status on landing for all migrant workers. Thank you.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for coming and listening to us. I was working as a temporary worker in a farm in Leamington, where I suffered an accident because my employer didn't provide me with safety equipment or training, nor treatment, or even helping me after my accident. So I complained to the Minister of Labor, and he got a fine. But after that, I was the target of a harassment, and finally, he fired me and sent back to Mexico. If we had immigration status, employers will push it to improve working conditions, homologating them to the jobs in other industries in order to keep his work with them. And no one will gonna leave his job if he is happy with it. I have to tell every person who comes to Canada to work, comes grateful and happy for the opportunity. But when they arrive, they face the cruel reality and feel like a slave. We are convinced that immigration status is the smarter and easy way to stop abuse of migrants workers in Canada. Thank you.
We also spoke with Ricky Joseph, who has been a temporary worker with the Seasonal Agriculture Workers Program on a farm in southern Ontario for the past 4 years. Ricky told us about the difficulties in being away from his family, who live in St. Lucia, for such long periods of time while working on farms in southern Ontario.
For example, today I was in touch with some of my relatives, and what happened is, in my situation, I have two kids. The mom passed away roughly 11 years ago. I'm the sole breadwinner for these children, and to be spending so much time away from them, that is really, really tough. Today, roughly an hour ago, I was told that my daughter, she's skipping school and to spend time with her boyfriend. So skipping school means, you know what is happening, right? Skipping school, that means she's missing out, right? Basically, it's all as a result of I spending so much time away from them. My son, I was just told that he's using drugs. And again, I'm not there. The mom is out of the picture, and I am out of the picture. So what can really help me? And I mean, what is the point in life of earning money and you can't share it with the people who matter to you most? Who are the people that matter most? It's your family, right? And the program as it is, it keeps you separated from your family. There's only one way I think that's possible to be working and have your family next to you is granting permanent residence or status on arrival for migrant workers.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Seasonal Agriculture Worker Program, and Justica for Migrant Workers will be organizing actions across Canada to highlight the resistance that migrant farm workers have undertaken to counter the exploitation they face as a result of inhumane immigration policies. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Samara Hemtula on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit in Toronto.
For our final feature, Sophie Harkat, wife of Muhammad Harkat, speaks about her husband's treatment and about living as a prisoner in her own home. Muhammad was arrested in 2002 under suspicions of having ties to Al-Qaeda. Muhammad spent 4 years in prison and has lived under house arrest for the past 7 years. The Supreme Court of Canada has upheld the security certificate that keeps him a figure of interest, and he is now facing deportation to Algeria.
So could you just briefly explain what a security certificate is and why you believe it violates the fundamental principles of justice?
A security certificate is under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. It's a piece of legislation that basically allows the government to arrest non-Canadian citizens, either refugees, landed immigrant, or non-status, and basically call them threat to national security and detain them for indefinitely without charge and without access to the evidence. So basically, your public counsels are kept in the dark about the evidence, and you're given a summary of allegations. It's not based on actual proof. It says that we allege, we assume, we think that in the past, present, or future, this person may be involved in acts of terrorism, part of the network. The decision is based on reasonable grounds to believe that the person might be associated to terrorism. So it's the lowest standard of proof in Canadian courts.
And what allegations were made against your husband?
Well, there's several allegations, but then again, it's important to mention allegations. One of the main allegations is that my husband went to Afghanistan, and he denies being in Afghanistan. He's never been there, and that he ran a guest house in Pakistan for members of Al-Qaeda, which he's never done, and he doesn't know the people that are mentioned in the report as well. The day he was released on bail, I became a full-time prisoner in my home and a full-time jail guard. The conditions were that he had to wear a GPS around his ankle 24/7. He could never take it off. He wore that for 7.5 years. We had 2 surveillance cameras in the home. Our phone was intercepted. Our mail was open. He had to be watched 24/7 inside the residence as well. So that would, at the beginning, there would be just myself, my mother, and a member of our committee that was allowed to do that. My mother works 15 hours a day, so I would do about 95% of the supervision. So that meant that I could not go to work or leave him alone. We were allowed to go out 3 times a week for a maximum of 4 hours. Every outing had to be pre-approved in advance, at least 48 to 96 hours in advance. So it was a very stressful, dehumanizing time for us. In 2009, the Canadian Intelligence Secret Services decided to drop the conditions, because that's the case against my husband, because they had assessed that he wasn't as big of a threat as they initially thought he was. So the majority of the conditions were lifted, except for the bracelet and several other conditions. For example, he's not allowed to be around technology like computers and cell phones. Just recently, he was allowed to have his own computer, but it's a monitored computer by the CBSA, and a cell phone as well. He doesn't have one at this present time, but he's allowed to have a specific model that would be monitored by the Canadian Border Service Agency as well. When they say a security certificate targets, for example, Muslim men or people without status, that is untrue, because when you become a surety to your own husband, you become a full-time jail guard, you become a prisoner in your home. Every person in my family had to be screened for a security clearance. Every friend that we had, we always lived around most conditions, so we were always planning our Christmas and other special occasions around most conditions. Several times he offered to go back in jail, but that was out of the question. But we all suffered, and everybody that loved him and everybody that knew him had to pass clearance and live with the conditions while around Mo. So it was difficult on everyone. In our case, our informant failed the lie detector test. CSIS lied to it about, well, not lied, but they never informed the judge about the results of the lie detector test. So the majority of the allegations are from that main informant. And when the Supreme Court ruled the first time that security certificates were unconstitutional, the government had 1 year to redraft a new law. In that law, they put in place some special advocates, which are security-cleared lawyers, which have access to the secret evidence, but they cannot discuss the information with the detainee and the public counsel, so we are left basically in the same position. The special advocates have mentioned several times that their hands continue to be tied behind their back. He's facing deportation because the main goal of a certificate is to deport someone back to their country because they're a so-called threat to national security. At this point in time, we're fighting the deportation. We've fought as much as we could on the law itself. So the only thing we have left is fighting the deportation law.
Now it's time for our community radio report. In 2006, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, NCRA, put together its first iteration of the Program Exchange, a digital system used to help distribute content among its members and media producers across the country for campus and community programming. Even at the early stages of file distribution, the NCRA recognized the importance of content sharing to members who would normally not have access to broadcast media aimed at meeting the sector's mandates. In November 2014, the NCRA recognized, through input from its membership, that there was now a need to update the Program Exchange, and with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada, sought to make the necessary updates. On January 20, 2016, the NCRA launched a revamped site with added features to make sharing audio more accessible, such as a new design, the possibility of sharing and collaborating on a series, podcasting capabilities, and national log sheets. The idea of sharing content speaks to the very concept of community media, which is about pooling resources and helping the community. Gretchen King is a longtime community radio programmer and was part of the news collective that forwarded the idea of a platform to share content in 2004, and also speaks to the importance of content sharing. Catherine Fisher from CJLY in Nelson, BC, tells us about her experience with the Program Exchange and its importance to her community.
In terms of the Program Exchange, part of the history of that exchange coming forward as a resource for all National Campus Community Radio Association members was that at one annual conference back in 2004 in Edmonton, a community news convergence took place, bringing together community news programmers from across the country. And one of the needs that came out of that convergence, as identified by people interested in doing news programming and sharing a news program together, was that we'd need a place to be able to exchange our programming. And so we decided that we'd put forward a motion for the General Assembly to consider developing a shared platform for exchanging community radio programming. And so that was passed by the membership, and within a couple of years, the NCRA Exchange was launched. And over the years, it's become a really valuable platform, not just for exchanging programming and sharing programming between stations, but also collaborating on programming together as a national sector that's trying to create a national voice representing diverse communities across Canada. And so we've used this exchange over the years to produce the Homelessness Marathon, which is a 14-hour radio marathon that happens live, but does include pre-recorded programming from across Canada as well. We've also used that exchange to produce the national editions of the Nakba broadcast, or the broadcast commemorating the Palestinian catastrophe in 1948. And we used the exchange to upload various programs, various panels, various discussions that fed into that bigger national and, in fact, international broadcast commemorating the 1948 Palestinian catastrophe, or Nakba. So the exchange in and of itself is not just valuable to connect stations to other stations' programming, but also providing that alternative platform by which we can create national programming.
It used to be called the National Campus and Community Radio Association's Program Exchange, but now it's been updated and relaunched with support from the Community Radio Fund of Canada as the Community Radio Exchange. I'm a longtime community radio volunteer living in the small semi-rural community of Nelson, BC, and my station, which is Kootenai Co-op Radio, uses the Program Exchange all the time. We're very proud of our local programming, but being able to share interesting and thought-provoking stories from diverse and grassroots communities in Toronto, Halifax, Lethbridge, Abbotsford, Winnipeg, and Windsor with our listeners is amazing. We frequently get calls from local listeners who appreciate that we can offer them this little window into other community radio stations and podcasts from all across Canada. Any media producer can sign up and upload content to the Community Radio Exchange, and anyone can listen to uploaded pieces. The exchange is searchable by topic, program type, program length, producer, or series. You can find the Community Program Exchange at previous.ncra.ca.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Music this week was by Wasson, off his new EP Comrade Music. Headlines this week were written by Audrey O'Braham and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Matt Weilish, Gretchen King, Ome Salma Rahmatullah, and Chris Ramzarup. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or podcast it at rabble.ca/podcasts, or download it at groundwire.ncra.ca. www.missingjustice.ca.